welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to talk about voting, yes, as the suppression trial continues on its final days towards decision and then probably on to the state Supreme Court. But a decision will be reached here in the next couple of days, or the trial will wrap up anyway. Also going to talk about bankruptcy, the Detroit situation getting a little interesting at this point. Jack LaLue says no bailout for you. So it looks like the feds are going to walk away from him. The banks, yes. Detroit, not so much. Also going to talk about the poverty tour. Republicans out on the poverty tour, assessing their handiwork. I'm sure if they find, when they find it, like, we did that. Very nice. Also, gays marriaging, my rage of the day, and your phone calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Hope you had a good weekend. Hope you had a prosperous weekend. Hope the weekend was filled with something positive. Our Republican friends, our governor, spent the weekend, the little powwow with the Chris Christie and the checkbooks. I'm not going to say Republicans. I'm going to say checkbooks. People who own our democracy. People who own our state. Going to see if the governor's viable for a second term, if all of his wonderful accomplishments. And I took a couple of minutes today thinking about all of the great accomplishments. You know, like the voter suppression thing that we're spending millions and millions of dollars fighting in the courts. We've wasted millions of dollars advertising and then sort of halfway unadvertising. Think about all the money we wasted on that. All for an ALEC piece of legislation. Think about that. We don't have money for education. We don't have money for roads and bridges. We don't have money to help the most vulnerable. But we've got money to basically... There's a P word I'm thinking. Okay, I'm not sure if I can use it. Probably won't. But to expel it away. Just get rid of it. Just gone. Done. Millions of dollars on this voter suppression thing. You think about Act 13. Remember Act 13? Where the people who tell us that we believe in local control, we believe in, you know, the rights of you know, localities, well, we're going to take that all away. We're going to take that away. We're going to give it to the state, and the state will decide if your local borough, township, city, state, or city, or you know, whatever county can say no to the drillers. Sorry. No. Sorry. You have to let the drillers in. How about the adult basic thing? Remember that? The court said, you really can't take that away and steal the tobacco settlement money. You really, really can't. Can't use that for something else. You know, what about the unconstitutional reapportionment? I mean, now, as someone who played baseball as a kid, I think of the state court said unconstitutional Act 13. They said unconstitutional stealing the money from adult basic. They said unconstitutional at the gerrymandering, redistricting, reapportionment, whatever you want to call it. They said unconstitutional the voter suppression thing. That's five strikes. And, of course, you know, last month, the block grant program. Remember the block grant thing? Oh, that was a wonderful thing. We're going to tell all the counties we're going to give them a block grant. And then the block grant we're going to give them, we're going to cut by 10%. Yeah, because the Human Services block grant. You remember us talking about this a while ago. Again, you know, you go back and you look at this. To me, that's six strikes. And the best part of this, these are conservative courts. I mean, they've been packed with the Republican pro-business minions who six strikes. And then you throw into that strike seven when a federal judge threw out the money, the NCAA thing. Oh, well, we agreed to the terms and we agreed that we're going to try and file a lawsuit on it just because we need re-election. And then you start and you think about the money that he spent on privatizing the lottery. To me, that's eight strikes. I mean, how many strikes does one batter get in an at-bat? And none of these were foul tips in my mind. These were just swing and a miss. Yet this weekend, they had the big powwow. The checkbooks have come out, and the checkbooks say, I don't know, not really much of a... not really much of a, kind of a, kind of just, I think we're stuck with this guy. We're going to have to eat it and move it out. Because they sent the lieutenant governor out. They sent Jim Cawley out to try and, you know, perk people up. He said, if Tom Corbett would have me on the ticket, I'd be proud and honored to run with him for a second term. The only place I really want to see Corbett running is out of the state, so Cawley could follow him. So take Corbett and gather the sheep and get the flock out. Seems pretty simple to me. But the lieutenant governor has said that Corbett hasn't decided. And he said, quote, we're not at a point yet to make an announcement. Like there are a couple. Oh, we're not there yet. Oh, going to make the announcement soon. Hope I get a ring. Oh. Although, you know, they're the people trying to make gay marriage illegal, so don't worry about that. He said, Andy, a lieutenant governor should not make news. Only the governor will make news. He said, as the governor said, this was a couple of nights ago, that the budget passed, we're going to continue with three initiatives. We're just getting started. Just getting started. Think about this. It's been 3 years now. Just getting started. It's over 3 years. Just now deciding to get around to something. So there's the three priorities that they put forth. Here we go again. Liquor privatization, pension reform, and transportation funding. The liquor thing nobody wants. The pension thing is a screw job ripoff. And the transportation funding should have been done 2 years ago. Just getting started. When? When did you decide maybe we should do some work? When did you decide, you know, maybe we should do something? I know, they wanted to privatize the lottery. And if you saw the news on Saturday, the company, the UK company, Camelot Global Services, at the governor's request, they have agreed to extend their bid offer to take our lottery. They've extended that to August 30th. Because the last, latest, greatest, whatever, bid was to expire July 31st, just a couple days away. Now we're going to go all the way to August 30th. That's the deadline. Absolute last time. For the ninth time. This will be the ninth extension. If you remember, the original dead last moment deadline, you do or we're going, was December 31st. Personally, I would expect another extension and another, because I don't see the lottery thing being privatized. I think it's a ripoff. But, you know, as long as the governor is pushing it as part of his failed agenda and Camelot sees a ton of money to be made, they'll keep extending this and going through the formality of asking and, okay, we'll extend it just for you, governor. Now, Corbett's made the case that Camelot, who is the only bidder, there was nobody else, they were the only guy, so you have really no idea through the competition and all that. There's no real idea. Corbett says that they're going to generate somewhere around $34.6 billion over the next 20 years, which Corbett says will be like $3-4 billion more than the lottery could do on its own, if you keep it the way it is. And my first question is, how the hell does he know that? How does he know? Because these projections that the Camelot's throwing out is adding new games and expanding the old ones. So let me ask a dumb question. Let's say we did it for ourselves. Let's say we said, okay, well, it's a foregone conclusion. Keno's coming. We're going to expand the scratches and all the other stuff. We're going to expand the hell out of those. Would we not do better if we held it where there wasn't a profit motive and the money was sucked out of the state and out of the country? Just a question. I'm just asking. Because it seems to me that because this $34.6 billion number is contingent on them getting Keno, which I got to be honest, I don't know anything about Keno. I'm not a gambler. So my gambling friends, if you know what it is, I would love to hear about it and if you've ever won. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. I don't know, don't care, I'm not a gambler. But at the end of this, I look at getting the lottery as an asset. Like the liquor stores, it's an asset. We, the taxpayers, hold this asset. It's paying taxes that we don't have to. So why would we want to privatize it and let someone else take the money out of the state? We're going to end up picking up the check anyway. seems dumb to me, especially in light of the last 2 years that have seen record-breaking performances. And, I mean, if you look at the polling says that you and me and everybody else really could care less about privatizing the lottery, or anything else for that matter. I love the chumped up, well, people wanna be able to buy liquor. No, no. People want to buy beer. Get that straight. And what I find really hysterical in all of this is it was, everybody's pointing at the state-owned liquor stores. We need to privatize those. Not from what I hear, from what some of the senators that I talk to, the liquor privatization is dead. It's gone. It's not a chance in Hades of it passing. But what's turned out to be privatizing these state-run liquor stores is now going, we'd like to have beer in the gas station and the grocery store, which all you private beer distributors, you're screwed. Because who's going to go buy a case of beer when you get a six-pack at the gas station? Let me say, nobody. Who's going to buy beer from a beer distributor when you can pick it up with your bread and milk at the grocery store? Because now when the storm comes, never mind the bread and milk being gone, the beer will be gone too. So again, I go back to how many people go to the beer distributor during the storm? Nobody. So I find that kind of ironic that the very people who are all in favor, yeah, let's privatize at their liquor store, guns trained on you. And in fact, the reason this is going to fail, and I've had a couple people who are close to a number of Republican senators tell me this. The whole reason it's going to fail is it's going to destroy the beer distributors. And the beer distributors, not happy. So the good pro-business, the good pro-free market Republicans who keep saying, you know, privatize and free markets, let the market decide. Well, the market's going to decide that the beer distributors, they go. Because if you can put a six-pack in every gas station, convenience store, or Walmart, or grocery store, or wherever, who needs a beer distributor? Huh? Just a thought. Just a thought. So it was an interesting weekend, $670 a night for a room at the Omni Bedford Resort and Spa. And I'm hoping that the GOP, with their big checkbooks, I'm hoping that they paid the top rate, which was $670 a night, and that they left decent tips for the workers there, who they probably ignored and didn't realize were in the frame. And I'm hoping, I was really hoping, and maybe they learned from the Romney experience. I was really hoping that someone would, one of the wait staff, would have recorded what was going on. Because I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to hear the discussions. Can they save Corbett from himself? I would have loved to have seen the video on that. And for all my low-wage worker friends who work at convention halls and stuff like that, please, we need the videotape. Because they don't know you're there. You could probably get away with it. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we're going to come back, we're going to talk with Representative Mike Sterla about the poverty initiative put out by the Republicans in the Pennsylvania State House and their listening tour, how that's going along and what we can do to help. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm The Talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Stop the moochers, shouted a flock of GOP budget whackers in the U.S. House recently as they literally ripped all food stamp funding out of the farm bill. They say they are shocked that use of this program has jumped so dramatically in recent years, crying that those people are costing us money. The House whacked the entire budget for getting food to the poor. Well, yes, food stamp use is up, but hello, clueless Congress critters. So is the need. Long-term joblessness and falling wages are sucking more and more of your constituents out of the middle class down into the vortex of poverty. It's disgraceful for you well-paid lawmakers to gut a poverty program that's working exactly as it's meant to do, at the very time it's most needed. But next, the flock of budget whackers suddenly flew completely off course. Going from disgraceful to disgusting, they approved a farm bill that gives ridiculous taxpayer handouts to the biggest and richest agribusiness operations in our land. Those entities are wallowing in record-high crop prices and farm income this year, yet the GOP's pious deficit skulls turned into free-spending corporate socialists, doling out the most generous farm subsidies in U.S. history. For example, they perverted the crop insurance program into an absurd guaranteed income plan for the wealthiest farms, each of which will collect more than $1 million a year from us. Moreover, these free market Republicans would also have the government, i.e. you and me, guarantee an artificially high price for various commodities produced by the giant farms. And they would make all of these subsidies permanent. This is Jim Hightower saying, no grocery money for the needy, but a free feed for millionaire farmers? That's a moral abomination. For more information and action, contact the Environmental Working Group, www.ewg.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
One of the objectives we have over the next couple months is to help folks understand some of the circumstances that lead folks to a life of poverty. It could just be one bad decision or one unfortunate circumstance that spirals to a life of poverty. And we hope to examine what those decisions are, what barriers are keeping folks in poverty, and helping to eliminate some of those barriers in the future for individuals and families across the state.
That's House Majority Policy Committee Chairman Dave Reed, the Republican, the majority leader here in Pennsylvania. And, you know, I'm listening to that. I'm going, one bad decision or one bad circumstance, like being born. How's that? Being born, is that a bad decision? I should have picked door number two. Door number two would have been the better choice. One bad decision, lifetime of poverty. Yeah, it's called the spiral of poverty. It's called the circle. It's called broken communities. It's called defunding schools. It's called allowing the minimum wage to evaporate. It's called, cutting programs to help people. Oh, yeah, it's just a bad decision. You shouldn't have grown up in that neighborhood. You shouldn't have been born into that neighborhood. No, no. And the bad circumstance, you live in a crummy neighborhood. You should move. Yeah, you should move. In fact, there's a state that's helping people move, poor people move. The state of Hawaii, for instance. Evidently the state with the highest rate of homelessness in the country. They've decided that they're going to help people move, change their circumstance. In fact, they've voted for a new policy. In fact, $100,000 over the next 2 years they're going to spend on their return to home program. They're going to offer you a one-way flight anywhere you want to go, wherever you'd like to go. One-way flight to Minnesota, being homeless, God bless you. There you go. Here's your ticket. And I'm thinking about this, and I'm going, you know, just a thought. Maybe that's what we could do. All of our poor people, the 1.5 million people who are living in poverty in this state, we could just send them somewhere else, right? Big bus theory. Put them on a bus. Drive them out of here. change their circumstance, change their situation. Maybe a change of scenery would help. What do you think? Ludicrous, right? And, you know, this whole empowering opportunities, gateways out of poverty initiative that I've been talking about for the last 2 weeks now. It's 2 weeks today that the initiative has been put forth. I'm not seeing any accomplishments, but I'm last weekend they did have a big powwow there in Bedford, and I'm sure poverty was on the agenda. The difference was is that they probably weren't talking about how to alleviate it or to solve it. They're probably talking about how to make it worse. Because, you know, people need to hit rock bottom before they can rise themselves back up. So if we can just make it worse, then they'll pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And the interesting thing is recently I had to actually explain to somebody what bootstraps were. So, you know, I go and I think about this and I go, well, if you don't know what bootstraps are to begin with, how can you pull yourself up by them? Just a thought, because, you know, I'm thinking about this because Chairman Reed has got me thinking about poverty. He's got me thinking about how do we solve the problem of poverty? The problem that they've made much worse by 30 years of horrible economic decisions. You know, understand, and they love to talk, well, you know, we spent $1 trillion on anti-poverty programs, and it's just getting worse. We just can't figure out why. Well, let me help you, because it's pretty simple. The Great Society, the war on poverty, was to bring people, lift people up. We said we're going to invest some money in education and job training and in programs that make sure that there's a line in the sand, no one falls beneath it. We don't have hungry kids. We don't have kids who can't go to school, who don't have clothing to go to school, who don't have safe neighborhoods. We decided we were going to do that. We were going to spend the resource because we were the wealthiest country in the world. We still are the wealthiest country in the world. We just have much different priorities, like making a handful much more wealthy. So you go from the passage of the Great Society up until right about the Reagan years, and there's something about the Reagan years that makes me go, there's kind of something there. Maybe we should think about the Reagan years. Instead of putting him on a pedestal and worshiping him, maybe we should be going, it was you. You know, it was you! Your policies that did all of this. Because that was a seismic shift in thought. Yeah, you know, everyone talks about the Jefferson Adams election, 1800, as in history being the biggest event in politics in civilized history, the bloodless change of power from one ideology to another. I would argue that Carter Reagan should be right up there. Because here you had a seismic shift in ideology. Now, Carter had bought some of the deregulation and privatization Kool-Aid too, but for a whole bunch of different reasons. So you had this mass shift where work was rewarded with decent wages, decent benefits, a voice. And families had a shot, had a share of what they created. Now you've had this seismic shift. And I look at all of the policies that have been put forth since the Reagan years to destroy the Great Society, to destroy the programs that as a kid I benefited from. And I could easily, and I've said this 1,000 times before, I could easily say, you know what? I pulled myself up by the bootstraps. I whittled them out of pure moral fiber and intestinal fortitude. I did it all by myself. It's not true, but I could say it. And then I would be a Republican because I would be a liar. The reality is that the community, we said, you know what? Kids are going to get an education. We said we're going to make sure nobody goes hungry. We're going to have school lunch programs. We're going to have summer school lunch programs. We're going to make sure that families get get help when they need it. Have some abused those programs? It's like anything. Some have abused it. But, you know, I tend to look at the welfare programs that we give to big corporations and you go, have they abused them? You bet your bottom line they have. So I look at this poverty tour. And, you know, I said from the beginning maybe Bush would loan them the Mission Accomplished banner because whenever they find poverty, they should lift that up because I believe it's their policies that have done this. Now, I said from the beginning, even before I had looked into this at all, my gut reaction, generally the right reaction, is that this is going to be about finger pointing. This is going to be about, oh, we need more faith-based initiatives. And we need less government. And that's what it's appeared to me. It's we can't help each other. Let the churches do it. And those poor people, it's their fault. Their decision. They made the decision to be poor. Yeah. And I remember one of the article that they pointed out that talked about the Empowering Opportunities, Gateways Out of Poverty Initiative, which I love the names. Love it. Empowering Opportunities. It's great. Because you got to give Republicans credit, man. They are great at messaging. I think it's the business background. It's the advertising. And we all know advertising is nothing but a bunch of BS. It's 30 seconds of lies. Time and time again. Lie to me as many times as you can in 30 or 60 seconds, and maybe we'll buy your product. One of the groups they talked about was this Palmyra Circles of Lebanon County, which when I investigated it, this is the one that they were going to vote. This is one of the poverty. We're going to go find poverty at the circles thing. I didn't disagree with the idea. I don't disagree with mentoring programs. I don't disagree with getting people involved in the community. Sounds like a good idea to me. But when you dug into what they're doing, they were hoping to help 15 people because, well, like anything, they're having a hard time attracting people who want to help poor people. So they were hoping to help 15. We've got 1.5 million people in this Commonwealth who are officially under the poverty line. So to me, you know, just real quick math, you know, that's 100,000 more of these groups we need. So I'm going, okay, well, all we need is another 100,000 of these groups. Who's going to do that? Oh, that's right. Nobody. You have one. And this is my problem with the faith-based initiatives. And this is brought to us by the Bush administration. This is my whole problem with the whole let the churches do it. Because if they could have, they would have. In the past, when they had total and complete control. In fact, I remember, and this is, again, one of those weird little things that I remember about James Madison, who was a preacher's kid. First veto was vetoing money to go to the church to help the poor. And it wasn't because he was against the poor or against the church. He didn't want the government money to corrupt the church. And I look around and I go, you know, when it's all about money, when it's God incorporated, what do you get? I mean, I sit here and I look at this whole situation where the policies put forth by the Chairman Reeds of the world have caused mass suffering. You go back to the human service block grants that we talked about at the beginning. Granted, it was only supposed to be a pilot program. But what it was going to do is it was going to cut 10% of the human services budget. But we gave it to you in a lump sum. So that's kind of like countywide Hunger Games, if you will. And I look at that and I go, well, you know, is there any surprise in that? That's who these people are. I haven't seen any press releases on the listening tour. I haven't seen any press releases from where they have heard or seen or met poor people. I still think it's something that we're trying to figure out how we can help them. How can we help the Republicans find poverty? There's only 1.5 million people in the Commonwealth who are below the poverty line. How can we help? It'll be interesting to see where the next coming couple of weeks go as we move into the next session. Because for me, and I've said this before, raising the minimum wage, that's, to me, one of the best ways to alleviate poverty. Raise the minimum wage, pass the Medicaid expansion so that people have some health care, so that they don't go bankrupt if they get sick. Job training, education money, and transportation, man. Put people back to work. This is not rocket science. This doesn't take a genius to figure out. And what's interesting to me, the more I sit around and I talk to people at lunch counters and the more I talk to people on the street, that's what they're saying. We need to put people back to work. In 2010, they voted for this guy because he said he was going to be the jobs guy. We're going to create jobs. Well, the more jobs governor, more than Wyoming, in the last year, you're talking about 1,000 net jobs. That's it, 1,000. It's one of the worst in the country. We were seventh. We were one of the better states in the country before he took office. What happened? Well, what happened is pretty simple. Bad policy, bad governance, misplaced priorities, misdirected priorities. And here we are, 3 years later, worse off than we were during the Great Recession of 2008. Because one of their priorities was to destroy unemployment compensation. So what'd they do? Got to bail out the business community, Rick. Got to help them because we're business friendly. They floated a $4 billion bond to pay back the unemployment money to the federal government because the employers over the last 26 odd years were paying a paltry sum into the fund while the employee paid every dime they were supposed to, every single week, on every dollar that they made. So the fix to this, you would think, the fix is, you would think, now, come with me on this. So you've set up a system where it's been underfunded for 26 years because you set the median wage at $8,000, which is what they were paying the unemployment tax on, up until they just recently, a couple of years changed ago. 2010 they changed it, or 2011 they changed it. So up to $8,000. Paid I forget what the number was, I think 2 or 3%. So they change it. They change it to raising that cap all the way up to 10%. All the way up to 10%. And they cut the tax rate in half. So by underfunding the UC plan, by underfunding it for those 20-some-odd years, the employers were given a reward of half the tax rate and just bumping it up a little bit. But how we're going to fix that is we're going to freeze that rate for a decade so that the unemployment benefit that workers who lose their jobs through no fault of their own, those benefits will be eroded by inflation. That's what our Republican friends have done. And I keep telling you, and I'll argue it until the day I die, what they have done the last couple of years has made poverty worse. So to see Chairman Reed with this disingenuous, oh, we're going to have empowering opportunities, Gateways Out of Poverty initiative, we're going to go look for poverty. These are the people who created more poverty. It's that simple. I'm going to take a quick break. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Talk.
Own 90% of the wealth. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth. fit in. Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Fast food and low-wage retail workers in seven cities will walk off their jobs in strikes this week in the largest action yet of low-wage workers demanding living wages and the right to form unions without employer retaliation. In New York City, Milwaukee, St. Louis, Chicago, Detroit, Flint, Michigan, and Kansas City, workers will walk off their jobs as they fight for $15 an hour and the right to organize. Rosalind Hardy works at Family Dollar and is a member of Stand Up Kansas City.
We're tired of it. We're sick and tired of just being, you know, just neglected and not heard. Like, all the work that we do every day, we come into these work, we come into these jobs, and we work to the bone, and we're just tired of it. So someone needs to stand up, and I'm glad I'm part of it. It's going to be a hard fight, and everybody needs to just stick their ground, stick to what they know, and don't listen to all the naysays and, you know, all the people that want to down you. Just fight for what you believe in and take a stand. And it's going to be a hard fight, but we're going to get there. People got there years and years ago, and we're going to get there too.
A proposed California law would increase protections for workers who use the state-paid family leave program. Jesse Russell reports.
A California bill intends to extend protections for workers who take advantage of that state's paid family leave insurance program. Under the current law, employees are allowed to take up to 6 weeks with partial pay. The law is intended to provide workers a way to take time to take care of a newborn or attend to an ill family member. While on the leave, the worker will receive 55% of wages. A study by the Center for Economic and Policy Research found that 37% of workers who needed and qualified for the program chose not to use it. Some of the reasons noted by the organization included concerns that employers would retaliate by denying promotions or firing the worker. The new legislation would prohibit employers from taking such measures.
The AFL-CIO Executive Council has issued a call for social and economic justice for communities of color. The Labor Federation's statement says that, quote, racism remains deeply rooted in American society. The Supreme Court has gutted the Voting Rights Act and weakened anti-discrimination laws. Too many Americans are out of work and facing unfair and discriminatory barriers as they try to enter the workforce. Racial profiling occurs far too often, creating distrust in communities at a time we need to be coming together. The AFL-CIO goes on to say that the Trayvon Martin case is a painful wake-up call and that much work remains to be done in the march toward opportunity and justice for all. The AFL-CIO says as the labor movement rededicates itself to this march for justice along with its allies, the AFL-CIO will be deliberate in its commitment to advancing a full dialogue regarding racial disparities and violence in all our communities. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And open up your eyes. Power, we stand and fight together. Power when we don't deny. Power, we stand and fight together. There's power when we don't deny. Power, when we stand and fight together. There's power when we don't deny.
Bringing sanity. Rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Yeah, I look at this and I go back. I've been talking about this now for 2 weeks because it was 2 weeks ago today that House Majority Policy Committee Chairman Dave Reed came out with his big initiative, Empowering Opportunities. Yes, you lazy people, when your bad circumstances and your bad decisions. See, if you'd have just picked door number two before you were born, all your problems would be over. See, that was that one decision, life of poverty now, your fault. I said from the beginning, this is going to be a finger-pointing exercise, and that's what it's become already. Here to talk a little bit about the initiative and poverty as a whole, I've got Representative Mike Sterla on the line. Mike, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I look at this, and I guess the first question I've got is, okay, you're the committee, the Democratic committee chairperson for the policy committee there. What conversations have gone on to help with Dave Reed's initiative? What are you guys doing to alleviate poverty?
Well, I mean, we've actually reached out to Dave Reed's committee and said, you know, we would be interested in, you know, holding some joint hearings. Look, I think if once they realize where poverty is in Pennsylvania in particular, they're going to realize that in a lot of cases it's right in their backyard. I think there's a notion that, you know, poverty is an urban issue. You know, the average, welfare recipient in the state of Pennsylvania is a single woman with children that lives in rural Pennsylvania, and she's white.
Yep. Well, I mean, that's just not Pennsylvania. That's across the country.
Yeah.
But what's interesting to me is, like, poverty is something new, and they have to go out and discover it. I would say when they find it, most of the poverty that's going on is because of their policies and the things that they've done over the last couple of years.
Well, I mean, I would have a tendency to agree. But look, as long as they're willing to discuss the issue, I'm willing to sit down with them and say, let's figure out what we can do about it.
Okay, let's talk about what we can do with it. For me, the first thing that should be done almost immediately if you want to alleviate poverty is reward work. And that means, to me, raise the minimum wage and do it now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of those things that, you know, we constantly see things where, you know, people want to do a, you know, combined unemployment work program. They want to do, you know, you name it, anything. The reality is, for many working people that are working at the minimum wage that can't make ends meet, they're still collecting food stamps. They're still doing a whole lot of other things that's considered welfare. Because it's not a living wage. It's a minimum wage. And, you know, people that want to talk about the prevailing wage or the minimum wage, I always say, let's talk about a living wage. You know, if we just had a living wage, I don't think anybody would complain about anything.
You know what I find interesting? You brought up prevailing wage there. And what I find extremely interesting is here you've got a guy who's got this listening tour, and I don't know what they've done yet. I haven't seen the press releases. I don't know if they've actually gone out and looked for poverty. We were out on an anti-violence walk here in Harrisburg last week, with Judge Evans. And to me, that's a poverty issue, there. I didn't see any Republicans. I didn't see them. I'm kind of curious what they have been focusing on, and I was hoping that you might be able to tell us if they've asked you to go on any of their jaunts.
Well, I mean, we've actually volunteered. We want to join in. I mean, one of the things that I think, you know, because you know, unless I find differently, I mean, I believe that the search is genuine. I just think that you know, for those of us that know that it's around us on a regular basis. I think many times, they see somebody who's working and say they're not in poverty, and it's somebody who's not who is, when in reality there's a whole lot of working poor, and there's a whole lot of people that but for, a part-time minimum wage job would not be working that are also even poorer. So it's a, you know, if this is a quest to find out who's poor, and we don't just focus on who's poorer than the poor, I think there's actually some positive things that could happen out of this, because I think people will finally maybe start to realize that, you know, there's a lot of rural poverty in this state. There's a whole lot of programs that a whole lot of working Pennsylvanians rely on that are considered poverty programs.
Yeah, I'm with you. I've said that from the beginning. If they're truly willing to open their eyes, which evidently they haven't seen poverty before, and this is a learning experience, I'm with them. But you brought up prevailing wage a minute ago, and to me, that's one of those living wage kind of things. To me, the prevailing wage is something that helps make sure that there is the industries stay fairly well paying, so that you A, keep an industry, but B, also have that reverberation effect into the economy and raise everyone up. Yet the people who are on this big tour, almost across the line, anti-prevailing wage.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, look, I've often said, people say, you know, like, let's get rid of the prevailing wage. And I say, okay, but do you really think that the government should employ people and pay them a wage such that they qualify for food stamps and other poverty programs? Or do you think it's incumbent upon us as a government, as the people, to say, we aren't going to keep people in poverty? You know, it's one thing to permit some privateer that's trying to make a profit to let somebody be in poverty. I don't agree with that, but you know, if you say, look, it's a private market and it's a free market and you go for it, and you know, but as a society, for us to say, we also condone keeping someone in poverty, I don't get it.
No, I mean, I think that's one of the central differences between Republicans and Democrats. There's the pro-business mindset that, you know, lowest cost, cheapest, you know, whatever we can do like a business would do. And then there's the pro-society idea. What's best for society? What's best for the community? I think that's one of the tenet differences between the two parties.
Yeah. Well, and what I think is amazing is that the pro-society, what's best for everyone, ultimately is best for business, because when working families have enough money to feed their family and are not relying on food stamps and are not relying on other anti-poverty programs to meet those, make ends meet, they're actually putting money back into the economy. I mean, there's no one that's working at a low-wage job that is taking their money offshore into a bank account. It just doesn't exist. They spend every penny they make in their community.
Exactly.
It is local dollars staying at the local level, working to promote the local economy. You don't get a better multiplier than that.
No, and the thing that gets me is, you know, I go back to it, and maybe it's painting with a broad brush and you don't have to go with me, but I look at all of the policies that I've seen come out of the Republicans who control our state government, from the governor on down, all of them, in my view, make poverty worse. And I look at, you know, the governor's idea to block grant the human services money to the counties, which, you know, fortunately was shot down, of course, with a 10% cut. To me, that makes poverty worse.
Yeah, you know, that was one of those things where, you know, under the guise of flexibility, apparently it was so flexible it went outside the bounds of the Constitution in Pennsylvania. But, you know, it was flexible as a sort of smoke screen for making cuts. I mean, we saw that in almost every line item in the budget, but that one was pretty glaring. We're going to give you flexibility. We're so happy about that flexibility, we'll cut you 10%, you know.
I mean, it's amazing to me. And, you know, one of the other things that I think almost has to happen, if you're really concerned about poverty, I think the Medicaid expansion money is an absolute. And I haven't, maybe you've got some different people talking to you, but I haven't seen any will from them to move on bringing that money into the state.
Yeah, I don't think so. And my guess is that won't be part of the discussions here on poverty, because I think they're waiting for the governor to make a move on that. And I really think that is one where I think that enough people, including the hospital association and, you know, those people that will literally shut down rural hospitals if that money isn't there, need to start going after the governor on this one and saying, you know, do you understand what you're going to do to rural Pennsylvania in particular? Some of the urban hospitals will be hurt, but they'll survive. It's the small rural hospitals that will close. And then those people in the rural areas, whether they're rich or poor, will not be going 50 miles to their nearest hospital. They'll be going 150 miles to their nearest hospital.
And they die en route.
Yeah.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterla talking about the grand policy initiative, empowering opportunities. You gotta love the marketing on that. I played baseball as a kid, and, you know, I was looking at the big powwow over the weekend as the checkbooks around the state are trying to figure out if Governor Corbett is viable in 2014. And I was thinking about all of the things that were struck down as unconstitutional and all of the things that were thrown back. And you look at the block grants that we talked about, Act 13, the
right,
voter suppression thing, the adult basic thing, the gerrymandering, all of these things, swing, you're out. At what point do we not go, he just got to go?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the amount of dollars that have been spent, taxpayer dollars that have been spent trying to defend unconstitutional ideas is pretty outrageous with this administration. And, you know, I mean, it's one of those things where, if you did any poll and you ask, and I'm not one to govern by polls, but, you know, if you do any polling on their initiatives, the public's kind of like, their initiatives are, you know, not even in the top 10 when you do polling. People are concerned about jobs. They're concerned about transportation. They're concerned about health care. They're concerned about education. And those are things they've either cut or just completely ignored.
Yeah, so you're talking about the transportation. We need roads and bridges. That's something people care about. Education, that's something people care about. Healthcare, people care about. So the jobs, people care about. So the Republicans go after lottery privatization, which
right.
I don't know if you saw. Got their ninth extension, the governor and Camelot Global, ninth extension. I'm expecting 10, 11, 12, but, you know, number nine takes us through the end of August.
Yeah, you got to believe that there's a lot of profit to be made for people to keep saying, go ahead, extend that possibility of me ever even getting anything. And meanwhile, I'll continue to spend more money in the hopes that someday I can cash in on that deal. There's a lot more there than I think meets the eye.
Oh, yeah. But you know, the thing is we've spent almost $3 million fiddling around with this. I'm going, well, couldn't we use that $3 million for something else? And not to mention that the money they've thrown down the drain with the NCAA suit and, you know, so many other things that the whole liquor store privatization to me is just mind blowing. We have nothing better to do.
Yeah. And I mean, you look at what they've tried to do to this point that the courts have said, I'm sorry, it's unconstitutional. And then you look at what they're still trying to do, whether it's for privatization or whether it's some of the pension things, those are all going to end up in the courts also. And if precedent tells you anything, in most of the cases there, they're going to lose. So again, they're using taxpayer dollars to try and promote an ideological agenda. But when you said about the checkbooks opening up, I mean, the one thing that I think is pretty obvious, there's a whole lot of people that got their rewards early on here. There will be no bonus gate because it's not you come out and help me in my campaign and you'll get a reward. They got the reward, but there's the expectation that these people come out and help in the campaigns. And I think you'll see the people that have seen the corporate tax cuts, the people that have seen their salaries boosted at the state level, taking leaves. You're going to see a whole lot of people coming out of the woodwork that you never thought were there, but that were funded by taxpayer dollars coming out to support this guy come election time, which is why I think it's critical that people, become active and really get involved in this election.
Yeah, I mean, this to me, and I don't mean to sound dramatic, but, you know, I keep telling my friends, my labor friends, he wins again. We're Michigan.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, it's that kind of a dire situation because every one of the same bad policies that we see in all of the crazy right wing states are here. It's just that it's been held down by a couple of rational Republicans.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one thing to say you held it back and the guy's going to be a lame duck and we can hold off for one more year. It's another thing to say we can hold off for 5 years because I think that eventually there's, you know, the economy turns enough to start buying votes. The economy turns enough to start, threatening people. At some point in time, the politics sets in. And if he comes off an election with a win, I think you'll see some of those things start to fly.
And then, you know, the part of this that's interesting to me is this whole voter suppression thing. That comes up. And I don't know if you saw the clip from Rob Gleason, the chairman of the Republican Party, who, in talking about the voter suppression, came out with this gem.
We cut Obama by 5%, which was big. You know, a lot of people lost sight of that. He won. He beat McCain by 10%. He only beat Romney by 5%. I think that probably voter ID had a helped a bit in that.
Yeah, I think he wanted to say had a big part of that, but he caught himself before he said it.
Yeah, right. That's the amazing thing is that, one, it's a slap to Mitt Romney because they aren't saying that Mitt Romney had anything to do with that it was basically voter ID that had everything to do with it. But the admission that they think that voter ID had a 5% role in an election, think of how many elections are won by 1% and 2% and 3% and 4%. And they're saying, voter suppression through voter ID has a 5% impact. It's pretty incredible to think what they're trying to do with the democratic system.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about consolidating power. You go to the voting thing, you go to the gerrymandering thing. So much of this, to me, not in a good direction.
Right.
Sad, sad stuff. Mike, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time. And if they come up with any poverty things, that I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the hope is that, you know, there's a lot of things that we've discussed in the past about poverty. And hopefully if we can become part of the discussion, we can explain why we've been talking about some of these things for many years.
Yeah, because I was surprised that you'd heard about it, because last week we had talked to representatives almost every day last week, and their offices hadn't heard of it because the Republicans didn't really reach out. To be honest, my first take on this was a publicity stunt, you know, oh, we care, and it was going to end there, because I still haven't seen any of the listening going on. I'm not saying it isn't happening. I just haven't seen it.
Well, we've reached out, and Representative Jake Wheely from Allegheny County called me and said, hey, can we become part of this? Because obviously it's something we've been concerned about for quite some time, and the fact that somebody's willing to talk about it now, let's talk with them. So
I'm right there with you. Mike, it's always great talking with you, brother.
Okay, you too.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Mike Sterla, Pennsylvania State Representative. No, I look at this, and you know, the reality is, you know, as I said, the policies that they have pursued, be it on the minimum wage front. Remember during the election where they said we should do away with the minimum wage? Yeah, just do away with it. And you know, Ron Paul said it. We're against mandates. We should be against the minimum wage. Because if people are desperate enough to work for minimum wage, that's what we should do. That's where we should go. Think about that from and to use the frame of pro-business versus pro-society. The pro-business person is saying we need to squeeze every dime. And I've said this before, having sat in on the pension hearings, where the Republicans believe wholeheartedly that government should be the leader in the race to the bottom. Versus what's really good for society. And it's two very different viewpoints. You know, I'm more of a New Deal Democrat. I believe that work should be rewarded. I believe that community is important and that we're all in this together. And that weakest link theory. I guess it's having played on a number of sports teams throughout my life that you realize that we're all in this and that it's the weakest link that brings you down, so you need to strengthen everyone. I don't see that from our friends on the other side. And it's one of those sad, sad things. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on your smartphone, take the program on the go. You can always email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this with Hour 2. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Fast food and low-wage retail workers in seven cities will walk off their jobs in strikes this week in the largest action yet of low-wage workers demanding living wages and the right to form unions without employer retaliation. In New York City, Milwaukee, St. Louis, Chicago, Detroit, Flint, Michigan, and Kansas City, workers will walk off their jobs as they fight for $15 an hour and the right to organize. Rosalind Hardy works at Family Dollar and is a member of Stand Up Kansas City.
We're tired of it. We're sick and tired of just being, you know, just neglected and not heard. Like, all the work that we do every day, we come into these work, we come into these jobs, and we work to the bone, and we're just tired of it. So someone needs to stand up, and I'm glad I'm a part of it. It's going to be a hard fight, and everybody needs to just stick their ground, stick to what they know, and don't listen to all the naysayers and, you know, all the people that want to down you. Just fight for what you believe in and take a stand. And it's going to be a hard fight, but we're going to get there. People got there years and years ago, and we're going to get there too.
A proposed California law would increase protections for workers who use the state-paid family leave program. Jesse Russell reports.
A California bill intends to extend protections for workers who take advantage of that state's paid family leave insurance program. Under the current law, employees are allowed to take up to 6 weeks with partial pay. The law is intended to provide workers a way to take time to take care of a newborn or attend to an ill family member. While on the leave, the worker will receive 55% of wages. A study by the Center for Economic and Policy Research found that 37% of workers who needed and qualified for the program chose not to use it. Some of the reasons noted by the organization included concerns that employers would retaliate by denying promotions or firing the worker. The new legislation would prohibit employers from taking such measures.
The AFL-CIO Executive Council has issued a call for social and economic justice for communities of color. The Labor Federation's statement says that, quote, racism remains deeply rooted in American society. The Supreme Court has gutted the Voting Rights Act and weakened anti-discrimination laws. Too many Americans are out of work and facing unfair and discriminatory barriers as they try to enter the workforce. Racial profiling occurs far too often, creating distrust in communities at a time we need to be coming together. The AFL-CIO goes on to say that the Trayvon Martin case is a painful wake-up call and that much work remains to be done in the march toward opportunity and justice for all. The AFL-CIO says as the labor movement rededicates itself to this march for justice along with its allies, the AFL-CIO will be deliberate in its commitment to advancing a full dialogue regarding racial disparities and violence in all our communities. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
One life leads to another two lives, covers the other three lives. Now you're in an awful fix. Four lives, you're getting in deeper. Five lives, piling up steeper. Get wise, or you're going to be telling six. You better listen and take care. Don't you tell seven, beware. You won't go to heaven up there. The good with the bad don't mix.
You won't go to heaven, no, no. Tony Bennett, I love Tony Bennett. That Tony Bennett, the singer Tony Bennett. Not so much the guy who's the head of the Florida schools, who is also named Tony Bennett. Former Indiana head of schools as well. He's our quote of the day, and I think this will be the quote, as my producer said, the quote he will have tattooed on his, well, we're not going to say what, but he's going to have it tattooed on him. He said, and he wrote this in an email, I cannot believe it, but here it is. I hope we can come to the meeting today with solutions and not excuses and or explanations for me to wiggle myself out of the repeated lies I have told over the past 6 months. Here's the situation. He's the head of the Indiana schools, saying, you know, this school's doing great. It's amazing. Our A through F school, our system is working. Everything's great. And this Crystal DeHaan's school is fantastic. It's going to get an A, nothing less. You're just pumping everybody up that these schools that are failing are actually doing fantastic. What's happened is they got a bunch of these emails that are going back, and it goes back to what my grandfather said, never put anything in writing. How they basically figured out how to take a school that was not doing well and turn it into an A school. On September 13th, evidently one of the employees of this school, this John Gruba, he said, hey, look, Tony, September 12th, Crystal House Academy scored less than an A. He said it's a huge problem. Evidently on the 13th, Mr. Gruba points out that 2.9, which is a C, is what the school was getting. And that's unacceptable because they have to be an A. Because we have, so we have to figure out how to adjust the presentations to make a B look like an A, make a C into an A. We have to figure out how to jiggle the grades. So on the 14th, his staff alerted him to a new school grade, which is 3.5. So it went in a day, went from 2.9 to 3.5. Oh, we're close to that, eh? We're close. Then on the 21st, it had jumped from 3.5 to 3.75, which is close to an A. and then the guy who did it resigned. This is my problem with the whole privatization of education thing. This right here, the quote, "I hope we come with solutions on how I can explain why I've been lying for 6 months." Repeatedly. To me, this is the problem with this whole privatization. Now, understand, the guy who's behind this, which, of course, he had to name it after himself, right? Crystal DeHaan's, his Christel House, the Academy, millionaire, has given millions of dollars to Republicans, a prominent Republican donor, including $130,000 to Tony Bennett, not the singer Tony Bennett, but the head school guy. This new breed of people who sees profit in education. This is who we put education, my kids' future, this is who we put them into their hands. It's amazing stuff. And I look at the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, which on their website was beautiful. They wrote, "Tony Bennett has proven himself an exceptional leader for improving student learning, raising expectations, speaking honestly about the challenges, and pressing for school reforms. Thanks to Dr. Bennett's tireless leadership and work, Indiana is leading the nation in education reforms, and we're already seeing real improvement in student achievement." Yeah, by changing the grades. See, I knew a kid who used to do that in high school. Went and he would change the grades. He got in trouble. He got expelled. And I guess you could say that Indiana did expel Tony Bennett, not the singer. They expelled him to Florida. The chamber went on to say the key to Indiana's economic success depends on the strength of our schools and our communities. This is why I'm humbled and honored that for only the second time in the chamber's history, they're endorsing a candidate for statewide office. Evidently, Tony ran for statewide office after his gig as the top education guy there. And let's say he would have won. Let's think that through for a second. Is this the kind of guy you want in government? It doesn't work the way we want to, so we're going to change it. But not change it to where the kids actually got an education and learned. Oh, no, no. Changed it so it looks good. That's just, man. You know, to cheat people out of an education just so you can make a quick buck or a name for yourself is insane to me. And I look at this new report out, a new survey from the Associated Press. They were looking at survey data. I said 80% of Americans, 80% of the people in this country are going to struggle with joblessness, live on the edge of poverty, or rely on public assistance programs for at least part of their lives. According to the report, it defines economic insecurity as a year or more of periodic unemployment, where you're going to need, you know, things like food stamps, LIHEAP, other government programs, or you're making an income of below 150% of the poverty line. They say the risk of poverty has increased in decades because of the assault on the Great Society, thanks to people like Dave Reed. People 35 to 55, they're the ones who have suffered the brunt of the fall. Because understand, you know, people on Social Security, they were getting cost of living adjustments. They were able to, because of the Great Recession, they were able to stave off a good portion of the poverty. But they looked at the periods from 1969 through 1989, and then to today. For the 35 to 55 group, from 69 to 89, those 20 years, that group had a 17% risk of falling into one of those categories. That's increased to 23% now. For the 45 to 55 group, from 69 to 89, it was about 11.8%, now all the way up to 17.7%. So you've seen you've basically seen the undoing of the Great Society. And this is what this is from. And as labor unions have become weaker and our global trade policies have become more liberalized, if you will, which means that employers can take jobs wherever the hell they want and have nothing here, I could care less, this is what happens. Now, the report goes on to predict that by 2030, which isn't all that long down the road, 17 years. That 80% number will jump to 85% of adults, which is why I go back, and I've said this to a number of my friends who point their fingers at, ah, oh, those welfare people collecting food stamps. Don't wish it away. Because the way things are going, throw Screwquester into there, which has made poverty worse, throw austerity in there, throw in dysfunctional, broken government into there, throw in no transportation bill, throw all of that stuff in there, and at some point or another, we could all end up into that. You know, I look at tomorrow, the president's going to be in Chattanooga, Tennessee, on his tour, where he's talking about, how he's going to make a better bargain for the middle class, which I'm all in favor of. I love the rhetoric, and, you know, if we're talking about better wages, better conditions, better benefits, I'm all in favor. But he's going to be stopping at one of the Amazon centers and giving a speech there. And look, you know, I know people who work at the Amazon locally. They work for temp agencies. Temp agencies generally pay lower wages, generally have no benefits, and, oh, by the way, you can't unionize. So the people who are doing the low-paid work, they're the disposable people. To me, sorry, that's not a better bargain for the middle class. It's not. Now, the Amazon place down in Chattanooga, Tennessee, recently, I guess within the last couple of months, announced that they're going to add 5,000 jobs across the country. Which, you know, Obama's going to, you know, look what we're doing. Problem is, most of the people I know, it's like 11, 12 bucks an hour. No health care, no benefits, no pension, no sick days, no vacation, none of that. Nothing. So you pick your little hearts out, or you load the little trucks, and when you get old and slow, to the door. I look at this, and I go, Is this the better bargain? Is this the better bargain? And you look at what we've done and what we've allowed, and it blows my mind what we have allowed. And it's what we put up with. And when we come back, I something happened today that I need more than a minute to rage about. Because I cannot believe how far we've allowed things to go. And how much we've taken. Now, I've always said that there's only so much of you-know-what people are willing to eat. At some point, you got to go. I've had enough. Which is why we've seen thousands of people in the streets today. And we're going to talk about that and so much more. We're going to take a quick break. Your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this. You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Stop the moochers, shouted a flock of GOP budget whackers in the U.S. House recently as they literally ripped all food stamp funding out of the farm bill. They say they are shocked that use of this program has jumped so dramatically in recent years. Crying that those people are costing us money, the House whacked the entire budget for getting food to the poor. Well, yes, food stamp use is up, but hello, clueless Congress critters. So is the need. Long-term joblessness and falling wages are sucking more and more of your constituents out of the middle class down into the vortex of poverty. It's disgraceful for you well-paid lawmakers to gut a poverty program that's working exactly as it's meant to do, at the very time it's most needed. But next, the flock of budget whackers suddenly flew completely off course, going from disgraceful to disgusting. They approved a farm bill that gives ridiculous taxpayer handouts to the biggest and richest agribusiness operations in our land. Those entities are wallowing in record-high crop prices and farm income this year, yet the GOP's pious deficit skulls turned into free-spending corporate socialists, doling out the most generous farm subsidies in U.S. history. For example, they perverted the crop insurance program into an absurd guaranteed income plan for the wealthiest farms, each of which will collect more than $1 million a year from us. Moreover, these free market Republicans would also have the government, i.e. you and me, guarantee an artificially high price for various commodities produced by the giant farms. And they would make all of these subsidies permanent. This is Jim Hightower saying, no grocery money for the needy, but a free feed for millionaire farmers? That's a moral abomination. For more information and action, contact the Environmental Working Group, www.ewg.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Ah, the sainted one himself, back from the abyss to lead us into the light. And, you know, I got to be honest, you know, I think back into the years, you know, my working years, and I think about how things have changed just in the years that I've been working. You know, being 46 now, you know, I'm looking, you know, just the last 20, 25 years, you go, really, things have changed that much? Now, it's been years since I've applied for a job. We went on the trip. We did the grand tour. And I forgot how much I loved driving. The trip for me was amazing because it was just an opportunity just to drive across the country, which was just fantastic. And, you know, as someone who drove a truck for a living, you know, you get bogged down because it's, you know, like I'm doing this every day, you know, thousands and thousands of miles a week, and you go, it loses it. But I really forgot how much I liked it. So I thought, you know, I talked it over with my wife. I said, I'm thinking about, I wouldn't mind getting a part-time job where, you know, once a week, you know, on a Saturday or Sunday, I take a road trip somewhere. You know, I'll find somebody that, you know, hire me on to, I don't know, driving to New York or something and back. You know, I could pick up a couple extra bucks, you know, and, you know, put into the vacation fund or whatever. But, you know, just to get out and, you know, stay, you know, to where I'm not rusty and, you know, just have a nice drive. So I looked around and, you know, there are a number of places that I contacted and, you know, I found one that I liked. And there's a huge difference between being, and I found this out, and I guess I've always known it, there's a huge difference about being desperate for a job and then being able to pick one. I didn't really need it, but I wanted, I knew specifically what I was looking for. So I was able to, you know, to pick out exactly what, and the interview goes much differently when the person across the desk knows you don't need the job. I just said, look, at the end of the day, this is what I'm looking for. This is what I want to do. And if you've got a spot, I'd be happy. If not, I don't need it. You know, we'll take a couple of weeks off or whatever. Company said, yeah, okay, this guy hired me to, you know, to take a weekend trip into Queens, you know, once a week. And I'm happy with that. So he tells me, well, you got to go get a photo. Got to go get a passport photo. I'm going, for what? Well, because you're going to need ID cards. You know, you need three of these passport photos. I'm going, really? You guys don't do it? No, you go and do it. So I go and I do it. And fortunately, I'm a member of AAA, so I went over, and they do it for free if you're a member. And they made me two copies, which didn't cost me anything. So I took it in today, and I said, okay, here you go. I said, oh, by the way, you know, do you reimburse for these? Oh, no. I'm going, what? And I know I didn't pay anything for it. I just wanted to see what the answer was so that I could rage about it. No, everybody pays for their own photos. And I'm going, let me get this straight. In order to work for the company, you have to have the ID that you mandate and your contractors mandate, but you don't pay for the photos? You don't even have a camera to do it? No, you just go to the post office. Now, understand, going to the post office to get a passport ID is $15, and they give you two little pictures. So I was going to need three, which would have been $30. $30 before you start a job. This blows my mind. And, you know, as I'm talking to people, they're going, well, duh, because, be honest with you, I haven't applied for a job in, well, last job I applied for was 1993. And every job before that, that was the first one I ever filled out an application for. All the other ones, I just went in and, there you go, you work freight? Yeah, well, here you go, get to work. It was that's how far things have changed. My first job, building houses, I didn't fill out anything except the W-2 thing. Guy said, can you swing a hammer? Yeah, okay, go to work. My first freight job, can you drive a forklift? Yeah, okay. You got a clipboard and dock hook? Okay, go to work. And over that time from, hey, can you do this, go to work, has come all of this other stuff. The application process for this one little part-time job was 30 pages long. Now you got to pay for your own IDs. I'm waiting to see what's next because, sadly, I don't know. I mean, I've had people tell me things that I'm left scratching my head going, really? Things have gotten that far down the road? I mean, to be honest with you, I would have never imagined that it would have gotten that far. When I first started, the companies used to buy you, if they mandated steel-toe shoes, they had to buy the shoes. And you go back to it and you go, this is when unions were strong. This is when you had 20% membership across the country in the private sector. Where one in five workers was a member of the union, and that meant, you know, probably the other half, there was somebody who had a job comparable just to keep the union out. So you had people who understood that, you know what, this is how we raise conditions. You got to pay for your own damn photo now. And you don't even have a chance, you don't even have a choice to get a check. Everything's direct deposit. You only have the choice for direct deposit. That's it. And maybe it's just that I'm getting a little bit older, that I see this stuff and I question it. But how much further is it going to go? I mean, are any of those things out there that you've encountered? Anything that you go, it's not right? Or have we stopped thinking that way? Have we stopped thinking that, you know, things aren't right and we should make them better? Are we just thinking, I'm just glad to be getting a job? Even though you're going to be in the hole, $30 to start. And the other part of this, you know, when you look at the poverty initiative, how many people have the $30? Honestly, you know, I thought this. Let's say you're somebody who, you know, you're in that poverty situation. You're in the circumstance or the situation that Chairman Reed talked about in the clip earlier. Do you have the $30 that would get you the photos before you even start the job? And then I was talking about with Brett as we were walking down for lunch this afternoon. He was going, you know, all the people who work fast food, evidently they have to buy their uniforms. And I'd love to hear how many, because when I worked at Wendy's, you know, a million years ago for a couple of months over a summer, they gave you a couple, I think it was two or three shirts, and two or three pair of pants so that you had, because it was their uniform, they mandated you wear it. If you wanted extras, you had to buy those, but, you know, two or three sets you got because they believed you should come to work in their uniform clean. Seemed rational to me. I wonder now, in looking at this, and, you know, maybe later we'll ask to see where it is today, but it just leaves me scratching my head going, you know, how much more is it going to, How much more down the road do we go with this? And what if you didn't have the resources? I mean, I'm pretty fortunate. I had the AAA. It didn't cost me $30. But if I didn't, screwed. Help so I can start the job. Now, I'm really, because this is the first non-union job I've had outside of the early ones, when you're a teenager. This is the first job. And I guess I wouldn't consider this a real job. It's, it's a part-time thing. But it'll be interesting to see, maybe an eye-opening experience for me. And maybe one of those things that makes me go, man, we've really driven down the wrong path. So I'm curious what your thoughts are, what stories you may have, what things have you put up with? What things caught your attention? Do they make you get the photos for your IDs? Do they make you buy your uniforms? Do they make you buy tools that you would need to work on their facilities and their you got to buy your own machines? Part of the question. But it infuriated me today because I think about the people who don't have the access. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com. That's where you can go get the podcast. Also, Stitcher. I'd be interested to hearing your thoughts. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, going to talk about the big events down in Philly as the Fix the Debt people came to town, Max Backdoris and the Klan with their listening tour. Quick break, right back.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseccu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 902-2561. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed.
with your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So while on the state level, you've got Chairman Dave Reed and the policy committee out there looking for poverty on their listening, they're listening tour trying to find out what poverty is on the state level. On the national level, you've got Senator Max Backdoris and, U.S. House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dave Camp, Republican from Michigan, on their listening tour, the tax reform listening tour, which came to Philadelphia. Again, you know, more of it's your fault. We need to cut Social Security. We need to change CPI, all of that stuff, because, well, it's you people who ran up the debt, not our bad policies and not, of course, the loopholes that we've given these huge multinational corporations. No, don't look behind the curtain. So as they're having their big event, there was a rally outside the Baucus camp meeting. I have one of the people who was there today. Kate Goodman is a member of Fight for Philly. She was at the rally today. Kate, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, no problem, Rick. Thanks very much.
So, what took you out to the big meeting?
Well, to be honest, the reason I went is because I'm angry. You know, I'm a working person. I work at a restaurant about 40 hours a week, making $10 an hour. So I'm not making very much money, and I'm a member of Fight for Philly and the PCAP Funding Steering Committee, and I'm watching the schools have to close a tremendous amount of schools, and it's looking like a bunch of teachers are going to get cut off. And I know at the same time that corporations aren't paying their fair share.
Haven't you heard, though, Kate? Austerity's good for us. Austerity works. If we cut education, we throw 20,000 teachers to the street, that's going to make kids learn better because they'll be hungrier.
Yeah, well, the politicians who say that must not be on the streets knocking doors and talking to real people. So they know what they're talking about. So, you know, we were hoping that by going to this meeting that we could get Senator Baucus and Representative Camp to listen to us. Unfortunately, we were locked out of a meeting.
Oh, no surprise there, because Baucus was the guy who, I guess they threatened to jail the single-payer people who wanted to even bring up the idea of single-payer when they were when they were doing the Affordable Care Act. So I don't think you were going to get anything out of Max.
No, of course not. So, you know, we were hoping we would at least be let into the meeting to observe what was going on. What we ended up having to do, we were able to talk to him because we waited outside of the door where the meeting was being held and basically, like, sidelined him so that we could speak to him. So he listened to us. There were about five or six community members there who want him to raise taxes on corporations, close loopholes, you know, do real tax reform that puts more money into working people's pockets. So, you know, hopefully he listened to us, but we had to force our way into it.
Yeah, I mean, we just finished a cross-country tour, and one of the places that we ended up was the Eisenhower Library, and I often say it would be great to go back to the days of a good socialist president like Republican Dwight David Eisenhower. When you look at the tax code that they had during his time, you go, that's how you make sure that you have enough money for education, for transportation, for all the things that we need.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And then, you know, they had a true tax code. It might say on the books that the tax code that corporations are paying 35%, but in reality, we know that they're paying a lot less. They're using the Delaware tax loophole. They have assets overseas. They're not paying anywhere near that rate. And you can see the real repercussions of that when they're closing schools and blaming teachers. We're fighting tooth and nail in Philadelphia to get Comcast to pay taxes. But their headquarters are on the books. They're in Delaware. They get, you know, they're getting a $15 million property tax abatement. They're not paying anything.
Jeez. You go back, and I'm reading a book, Who Stole the American Dream, and you know, I'm looking at this, and I'm going, you know, you look at the period from World War II till Reagan, and then from Reagan till now, we're talking about two entirely different countries with two entirely mm-hmm. different visions. One vision was, how do we build a strong nation together, and, you know, this latest vision is, version is, you know, how do we enrich a handful at the expense of all of us?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, David Cohen is the CEO of, he's not the CEO of Comcast, but he's one of the vice presidents who does all this, who does the political wheeling and dealing. He makes $22 million. And a lot of, most of his income on the books is in the stock market. So he's not paying income tax on any of that.
Yeah, but if you would work for, if you would work for less, Kate, he could have $23
million. Yeah. Right.
I mean, that's what we're being told, that, you know, the guy who's the CEO of Caterpillar said that there's never enough profit, never. And to me, that mentality says that, well, wages, you're under attack. Benefits, forget it. Health care, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Retirement, a thing of the past. And I look at these fix the debt people who keep telling me I need to expect a lower standard of living and less security in retirement. I say, well, wait a second. That's not the vision I have for this country.
Yeah, and the scary part, Rick, is that you would expect rich CEOs to be, you know, spouting those sorts of talking points and trying to enrich themselves. You wouldn't expect our, you know, even so-called democratic progressive elected officials to, like, roll out the red carpet so that kind of thing would happen. You know, we don't even have control of our own government because Democrats, even in Philadelphia where Democrats are in control, they're listening to CEOs, and their ideologies are aligned with these CEOs. They're not listening to the people who elected them. Well, so we don't have anybody speaking up for us right now.
At the end of the day, Kate, the reality is the statistic I saw was like 90% of the money Republicans get comes from Wall Street, but like 85% of it, the money that Democrats get, comes from Wall Street. What Wall Street wants, Wall Street gets. And to me, this whole fix the debt thing is what Wall Street wants. You look at right now, the collapse happened. Who's fat and happy? Who's back to normal? They are.
Mm-hmm.
It's the rest of the country that's screwed. And it's people like you and me who've got to roll up our sleeves and tighten our belts and struggle and suffer.
Yep, you're exactly right.
So what do we get people to do? I mean, I love your sentiment. We're angry. I know a lot of people who are ticked off. What do we do?
There's a lot of work to be done. I mean, I've been a community organizer before and a labor organizer, so I think it's going to take a giant coalition of labor, community, just regular people who are angry. I mean, we have to fill the streets. We have to aggressively go after our legislators. We have to kick some of these crappy corporate Democrats out of office. We need to find a way to, like, break the communication between corporations and our elected officials. I don't know exactly how we're going to do that, but, you know, I'm part of a lot of groups who are working on interrupting those channels of communication right now because we have a broken democracy. We can protest all we want, and I haven't seen a lot of proof that our elected officials are listening to us.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's going to take people like you and me and our listeners to get to the streets, to get active, be organized and engaged.
Mm-hmm. And to think of creative new ideas, because what's worked in the past, it might not work now.
No, I'm with you. But at the end of the day, for me, it's when you've got boots in the ground, you've got people in the streets, I think good things happen.
Yeah, I agree with you. We're going to have to take drastic measures to make our elected officials listen to us.
I mean, because at the end of the day, when you're talking about cutting education funding the way we have done in the state, billions of dollars over the last couple of years, and then turning around and handing them off to huge multi-state, multinational corporations, or destroying the unemployment comp bill here in Pennsylvania and giving huge tax breaks to employers, there's got to be a point where people say, you know what, there's only so much of it I'm willing to eat. I'm done.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a point. I don't know whether it's going to be this year or 5 years down the road, but there's going to be revolt because when people really realize that the reason why they're poor is because there's a small group of elite that's rich, you know, they're going to wake up and you know, take action. But we may have to wait for that to happen.
They're poor, not because of their circumstance, like being born.
Mm-hmm.
They're poor. If I listen to my Republican friends, people are poor because they're lazy and they're stupid.
Yeah, they obviously haven't, like, lived in my neighborhood because I see people going to work, working really, really hard every day. You can't get rich by making, you know, $7.50 an hour, working 60 hours a week.
So let me ask you know, they had the big hearing today. They had the big, the listening tour. What did they hear? I mean, who did they hear from? Obviously, you said you couldn't get in. So who did get in? Who were they listening to? I guess if you weren't allowed, people who live in the city, Who'd they listen to?
I can only guess that they had like a handpicked group of like corporate representatives. I'm not sure. The only person with a name tag I saw walking out was someone from the AARP. Other than that, I can only guess it's the same group of people, maybe Aramark, Comcast. I don't know. A lot of the newspapers say they're listening to mom and pop businesses. But I doubt that's the case. I work for a small business and I know that my employer is getting slammed with taxes. A lot of times they try to conflate small and large businesses, saying that businesses in our country have a large tax burden, but that's not the truth. The truth is that, you know, small businesses are also going to benefit from big businesses paying more taxes. So, you know, I don't know who was in that meeting.
Yeah, well,
they handpicked them. I'm sure they said exactly what they planned for them to say.
I'm sure it was well scripted, but, you know, at the end of it, you're right. It's the small businesses who get hit with it because they don't have the money to hire the tax avoidance people to take advantage of all the loopholes that big businesses lobby
for. No, yeah, exactly.
It's sad, sad stuff. Kate, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much, and thanks for being out in the streets.
Yeah, no problem, Rick. Good luck. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much. Another person who was there today, I've got Leanne Kruger Branicki. She's the director of fellowship and alumni business alliance for local living economies. Also the former director of Sustainable Business Network of Philadelphia. Leanne, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for the invite.
So you were there today. Did you get to testify?
I did not. I was asked as someone who's worked for a lot of businesses, small businesses in Philadelphia and is now working with small businesses across the country to represent a different opinion, which is that, you know, small businesses need a level playing field too.
So, you know, I'm looking at this and from a different perspective. You know, you would think that all the pandering to small business, they would be willing to listen to someone like you.
So I was asked yesterday, actually, to get involved in the rally. So I heard about the event pretty late in the game, but was asked because, you know, they felt like a small business perspective was important.
Okay, walk me through it. What if you got to testify in front of and be heard by Max Backus and Mr. Camp, what do you tell them?
Well, you know, there's this perception, right? We heard a lot of rhetoric, especially over the past year coming out of Washington, that any tax cuts was going to actually hurt small businesses most. And the reality is that that's not true, that 97% of small business owners are currently earning less than $250,000. But especially when everybody was afraid that we were racing towards this fiscal cliff, every politician was talking about the negative impact on small business owners. The reality is that's not true. Small business owners would benefit by the most wealthy Americans and big corporations paying their fair share of taxes.
And to me, you know, I look at this, and it's something that we used to know. I mean, I go back to my grandparents' generation. You know, as a society, we used to know that. And I look at the education process that's gone over the last 30 years where we've bought into this, if we give the rich people all the money, they will take care of us idea, and it just hasn't worked.
Well, the perception, and again, this is untrue as well, the perception is that they're the job creators. And we know that that's not true, especially in Philadelphia, actually. Right now, small businesses are the job creators. Over half of the new jobs being created in Philadelphia are created by businesses with less than 50 employees, and most of those are from companies that are young, you know, 5 years old or less. And so these are the kinds of companies that are really creating the jobs that we need, but that's not what we're hearing out of Washington, D.C. these days.
Help me with this, Leanne, because, you know, I've taken the position that, you know, most of those small businesses, you know, mom and pop right there with maybe 4 or 5 employees, those aren't the minimum wage employers. Those are people who are trying to do better, trying to get their employees health care, trying to take care of them because, well, they see them every day, and you don't want your people, your employees living in poverty right before you. So for me, the idea of encouraging small business growth is also good to raise poverty, to raise people out of poverty.
That's true, yes. We, at the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, we really believe that it matters that when people who are making the decisions in the businesses are in close proximity and relationship to the folks affected by those decisions, whether it's their employees or the neighborhood surrounding the business, that better decisions get made, period, that benefit all stakeholders.
So in your view, what's being proposed by the fix the debt people, where do they go wrong? What should they do differently?
I often think that policy that's good for big business is just masquerading as policy that's good for small businesses. And what small businesses need are for us to end tax breaks for companies that are shipping jobs overseas, level the playing field, make sure that all businesses are paying the same tax rate, not just the smaller companies who can't afford the fancy lawyers to find the loopholes.
I'm with you. And maybe if they would listen to you, maybe we would get better policy.
I think that's true. And I think that the conversation is changing. I was at a summit at Harvard University 2 months ago called Growing the Impact Economy. And they were talking about how local businesses and companies that are having a positive impact on their employees and doing it because it's the right thing to do and not doing it because they're being forced to do that really are the folks who are going to help get our economy back on track. And there was lots of conversation, even in a place like Harvard, about how to legislate in favor of companies that are going to do good for their communities.
Yeah, I'm with you. But, you know, I look at our president tomorrow is going to be in Chattanooga, Tennessee, at the Amazon facility there. And, you know, as we found out here, like in Allentown and here in the Carlisle area, Amazon's one of those companies. It's 20,000 people nationwide. But a good number of those jobs are fairly low-paying temporary jobs, not the kind of middle-class sustaining jobs that we would have. So I guess the idea of, you know, we see these huge companies saying they're adding more jobs, you know, what kind of jobs are they should be the question we should be asking.
Well, and in most cases, actually, I mean, I think there's this myth around economic development policy that the way to create jobs is to attract in a large company, but usually you're tempting them from another state with loopholes and tax breaks, and that's how you get the job creation. And more research is showing that actually doesn't work. The New York Times did a scathing story last year showing that in cases where companies are attracted to create jobs, that the jobs are never delivered. But investing in locally owned companies, helping to grow the companies that are deeply rooted in these communities, is a cheaper economic development strategy, and it leads to more jobs over the long term.
Yeah, and to me that seems like common sense, yet the second point, it just doesn't seem to me on the federal level or on the state level to be getting through it. I'm hoping that we find more people who are hearing and coming around to what you're saying.
Well, we're actually seeing that this is a place where economic policy is changing from the ground up, from the grassroots level, and that more and more there are folks at the local level who are realizing that, yes, local ownership matters. We want to see the state level and federal level policies change. And right now we're inspired by seeing local municipalities lead first.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I would love to see the whole beggar thy neighbor economic development stopped, and I'd like to see it stopped by the federal level. Use the commerce clauses if you have to. But this idea of, like where I live in Carlisle, Tennessee gave $34 million to Carlisle Tire and Wheel, and they up and moved a facility that had been in the community 93 years for a tax break.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
And basically you're destabilizing communities for a couple extra dollars. And I think at some point you have to say rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, not really a great idea.
Yep, and that's why we believe that local ownership matters, that independent business decision-making matters, and that these are the companies that are most deeply rooted in the communities who aren't going to go anywhere. That's where the policy should be. That's who should be supported in policy effort.
I'm right there with you. Leanne, I appreciate the time. Thanks for the information. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Let's take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com. Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized the renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The Rick Smith Show.
The walls came down.
I want to 1-888-520 Rick. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Randall during the break sent me an email, and you can too, rick@thericksmithshow.com. He says, my friend down south was working for a temp agency who was subcontracting for Amazon and recently got fired for scoring a 96 instead of 100. He was an older worker who showed up every day, but was having trouble competing with the younger workers. And, you know, I remember, you know, I go back to, you know, when I first started working in the freight industry, and there were older guys, you know, guys who worked 30, 40 years on the dock humping boxes, and there was just no way they were going to compete with a 20-year-old who, you know, at the time I was benching well over 300 pounds, in the best shape of my life. There's no way they were going to compete with me, nor should they have had to. Because if that's what we're going to do, because you know what? Here's the thing. That 20-year-old became that 40-year-old, becomes that 50-year-old or that 60-year-old. If that's what we're heading toward, we're all heading down the wrong path. And this idea that you can have temp agencies and you can be fired, wow, you're scoring only a 96, not 100, we can get 100 young kids to come in and do that. There's something seriously wrong with our society and the way things are done here. And maybe there's part of me that goes, you know what? Maybe we go, well, this is another reason why we organize. This is another reason why we put in some job protections. Because the one thing that those temporary workers don't have, they don't have job security. You know, over the years on this program, we've talked to people who have worked for logistics companies and third-party logistics companies. And what ends up happening is you begin organizing, driving. Oh, gee, the contract was not renewed. All you people are fired. And the lesson, the message is don't organize. Put up with the horrible conditions. Put up with the poor treatment. Put up with it. Or you'll get nothing. And we'll put you into poverty. Because one of the things we learned in 2008, that if you lose your job, straight to poverty. Because I've met so many people over the years who said, you know, when I lost my job, I thought it'd be, you know, a month or two, I'd have. Because we all like to believe, yeah, well, I'd find a job in a heartbeat. Yeah, I know a guy looked for 2 years before he could find a job. I mean, he'd get hired on somewhere, he'd work a couple of weeks, I'm sorry, we ran out of work, there's the door. Last hired, first fired. Sadly, Randall, that's nothing new. You know, we've heard that story before a number of times, but I appreciate the email. Mm-hmm. As always, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, the podcast's there at the website, thericksmithshow.com. Also, Stitcher on your smartphone, all that. You can check out the website there or our Facebook page, Twitter, all of that. And if you missed any of our tour, PeoplesTourForAmerica.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back with hour three. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Fast food and low-wage retail workers in seven cities will walk off their jobs in strikes this week in the largest action yet of low-wage workers demanding living wages and the right to form unions without employer retaliation. In New York City, Milwaukee, St. Louis, Chicago, Detroit, Flint, Michigan, and Kansas City, workers will walk off their jobs as they fight for $15 an hour and the right to organize. Rosalind Hardy works at Family Dollar and is a member of Stand Up Kansas City.
We're tired of it. We're sick and tired of just being, you know, just neglected and not heard. Like, all the work that we do every day, we come into these jobs and we work to the bone, and we're just tired of it. So someone needs to stand up, and I'm glad I'm part of it. It's going to be a hard fight, and everybody needs to just stick their ground, stick to what they know, and don't listen to all the naysays and, you know, all the people that want to down you. Just fight for what you believe in and take a stand. And it's going to be a hard fight, but we're going to get there. People got there years and years ago, and we're going to get there, too.
A proposed California law would increase protections for workers who use the state-paid family leave program. Jesse Russell reports.
A California bill intends to extend protections for workers who take advantage of that state's paid family leave insurance program. Under the current law, employees are allowed to take up to 6 weeks with partial pay. The law is intended to provide workers a way to take time to take care of a newborn or attend to an ill family member. While on the leave, the worker will receive 55% of wages. A study by the Center for Economic and Policy Research found that 37% of workers who needed and qualified for the program chose not to use it. Some of the reasons noted by the organization included concerns that employers would retaliate by denying promotions or firing the worker. The new legislation would prohibit employers from taking such measures.
The AFL-CIO Executive Council has issued a call for social and economic justice for communities of color. The Labor Federation's statement says that, quote, racism remains deeply rooted in American society. The Supreme Court has gutted the Voting Rights Act and weakened anti-discrimination laws. Too many Americans are out of work and facing unfair and discriminatory barriers as they try to enter the workforce. Racial profiling occurs far too often, creating distrust in communities at a time we need to be coming together. The AFL-CIO goes on to say that the Trayvon Martin case is a painful wake-up call and that much work remains to be done in the march toward opportunity and justice for all. The AFL-CIO says as the labor movement rededicates itself to this march for justice along with its allies, the AFL-CIO will be deliberate in its commitment to advancing a full dialogue regarding racial disparities and violence in all our communities. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Gasoline, groceries, and our hate is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So today, thousands of fast food and low-wage workers walked off a job in numerous cities across the nation. Beginning today to protest low wages, poor working conditions, and no benefits. In addition to better wages, hours, and conditions, these workers are fighting for their right to join and form unions without a fear of retaliation or harassment. And it's something I've been calling for the last couple of years, that eventually we're going to make the jobs that are here, those family-sustaining middle-class jobs, like my grandparents' generation did with the mining and manufacturing and truck driving and all those jobs of that era's middle class. So I'm glad to see this, and that's why I've asked Martin Raffan, and he's a community director for Can't Survive on 735. St. Louis 735.org is the website. Martin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, good to be here.
So I look at this, and, you know, something I've been saying has to happen, that the people that have been exploited in this economy for far too long stand up and say no. So congratulations, one, but two, how do we get more people involved? How do we get the general community involved in this?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is these workers are very courageous, inspirational, and they have stepped it up really big time in our community. So our goal as community supporters is to stand alongside them and to give them the space necessary for them to continue to show strong leadership and expand their movement. We're very proud in St. Louis that the workers here have really taken another step. I mean, we had our first strike in May on the 8th and 9th. We had 100 workers out in 30 stores that were struck. We believe that this time out we will expand those numbers dramatically.
Yeah, I was, you know, at the bar having lunch today with my producer, and on television they were actually covering it. And I got to be honest, I stopped dead in my tracks, and something of a mainstream media outlet was covering this issue, which I just said, you know, maybe there's a changing tide in this country.
Well, you know, the fast food industry is making our case for us. As you know, McDonald's put out their own little budget calculator recently, and they have pretty much put right on the table what we have been arguing, that they're paying wages that don't come anywhere close to meeting the basic needs of workers. And yet this is a highly profitable company. They can afford to do much better relative to their workers and to support our communities much more strongly by paying a better wage.
Yeah, well, they do fairly well by their CEO. I mean, McDonald's paid their CEO $8.75 million, which, you know, if you were working, you know, as one of the people who are actually making the profits, you know, the person behind the counter or the person making, you'd need to work in excess of a million hours in a year. And for the people who say, you just got to work harder and pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
They'd have to work for 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, there just aren't a million hours in a year.
Yeah, I mean, this is they have one thing to keep in mind is they haven't had any trouble in the last 5 years raising management salaries by a strong amount across the board in the fast food industry. And they have kept worker salaries level really over the past 5 years. So we're just asking the industry to be much more fair in their compensation relative to workers. And we believe that that will happen when workers are able to be represented,
and
because those two things go together.
I'm with you. And, you know, I look at this, and I look at the website that you brought up, and we had talked about it last week. McDonald's themselves has come out and said that you need to make double what they pay. So, you know, a couple of months ago when we had people on from New York saying $15 an hour, I had some people go, wow, why don't I just pay them $100 an hour? McDonald's themselves is saying that you need to make 15 bucks an hour to live.
That's what they're saying, basically. They're asking, you know, they put a full 40-hour job, and then they say, go out and get another 40-hour job. And that's what you need even basically to get by. So, and this came on the heels also of the Economic Policy Institute's report a week earlier about what it actually does cost for a family to live even a moderate lifestyle in most of our cities across the nation. And the indication that information along with the McDonald's information really has made our case powerfully that basically there's a huge disparity between what is paid by the fast food industry and what their workers actually need. And then we also know, though, that the fast food industry is highly profitable, it's a very successful industry, and they certainly have the cash to compensate their workers more fairly.
Well, what do you say to the person who says, you know, well, you know, fast food workers, you know, like for me, for instance, when I was a kid going to high school, it was a high school job. Fast food workers are just high school kids and grannies trying to make a little bingo money.
Well, that's not the case. I mean, the average age of a fast food worker that many now know is 28, 29 years old across the United States, that 65% of fast food workers are women. Average age of a woman in fast food is 32. With a family, with children. So obviously now these are jobs predominantly that are career jobs for many people. And so what you said earlier about making these jobs good jobs for people in our communities is exactly right. These jobs aren't going to China. They are good jobs. We need to make them good jobs, make them middle class jobs. And that's what these workers are asking for, and they know that that can't happen. They want a living wage, not, you know, we can talk about raising the minimum wage. That's a good thing. But literally raising the minimum wage to $9 or $10 or $11 is not enough. These workers deserve better than that, and they know that they can't receive that without really finding a way to get themselves represented in the workplace.
Yeah, at the end of this, Martin, and I look at it, and I go, because I go back to my grandparents' generation, who, you know, when they came back from World War II, they fought on the shoproom floor to make sure that those jobs. My grandfather drove a truck, and when he started driving, it was a poverty wage job, and it was because of organizing. He was a Teamster for 30 odd years. It was because of that union membership and those contracts that they were able to expand what those jobs paid, made the conditions better, and oh, by the way, had some retirement security when they got older. I look at the jobs that we have today, and I firmly believe that we can and that we must do what that generation did so that that generation has the same dignity and respect in old age that my grandparents had.
I agree with you. Our grandparents were able to do it. Our parents were able to do it. Now we need to step up and get it done. And that's exactly what these workers are doing. And across the nation, they're stepping up. And I'm, you know, the person in St. Louis that organizes community support for STL 735 and for the workers. So in St. Louis, we're really proud that we have a large number of very highly supportive persons, leaders who are willing to stand with fast food workers and provide them with an opportunity to continue their the expansion of their movement and to develop the strategies and the power necessary to get what they want.
Yeah, at the core of this, don't you think that it's about rewarding for work? I mean, we hear a lot from the Republicans, especially about, you know, getting people to work and being responsible and taking care of themselves. But at the end of the day, I mean, isn't it really about putting reward back into work?
Well, we want people to be paid a fair compensation. And in this industry, that's you know, they're trying to get away with the very least that can be paid to a worker. They're just looking at labor as a commodity and figuring out what the lowest price is that they can pay for it. That, I believe, is morally wrong. But I also believe that it's not it's just not smart for business. If we pay people fairly, compensate them well, expect them to be accountable for what they need to do and to improve the business, they are going to not only improve the business, but they are going to be spending the dollars in our community that will actually move our economy forward. Right now, you know, you're putting the dollars into the wrong hands. Those hands are not spending the dollars in our communities. And we need workers. We need workers to get that extra money into their pockets because we know where they're going to spend that money. They're going to spend it in our communities, building small businesses, large businesses, and moving our economy. And that's what's required. And again, that's why we in St. Louis talk about STL 735. It's not just about workers. It's about St. Louis. St. Louis can't survive with $7.35 an hour jobs. You know, and when people say, well, these workers are asking for $15. I only make $11. I only make $12. Well, you should be thinking about making $15.
There you go.
You know, you need to start jumping in there and figuring out why you are not making a fair wage and a living wage in our community.
I really hate that argument. Well, I don't get it. Why should they? Instead of going, well, then how do I get it too? I guess, do you think it's that we used to think that way? Because I think about my grandfather who would see something, well, how do I get that instead of denying it to you? We've kind of been shifted into the denying it. Same thing we see in this state about pensions. Well, I don't have a pension. They shouldn't have one. Instead of going, hey, how do I get a pension too?
Exactly. I mean, we've had the wool pulled over our eyes. One good example of this is just even in the minimum wage debate. I mean, in 1969, I started my first minimum wage job, and it was $1.65 an hour. Well, you know, that wage in adjusted for inflation today is, you know, $9.50, almost $10. So, I mean, so even this $7.25 minimum wage has been reduced by 30% over the last three decades.
Yeah.
People are having the wool pulled over their eyes. I mean, what we need is a wage that really provide some level of meeting the basic necessities of people's lives. And if corporations can be more fair in their compensation, then we as citizens also will not be needing to subsidize these low-wage salaries.
And that's the other part of this. Yeah, I mean, that's the other part of it. We're subsidizing these low-wage employers, and we're actually incentivizing them to pay crummy wages so that they can then force workers to get the Medicaid and the LIHEAP and food stamps and all of this stuff so that we, the taxpayers, are actually subsidizing it. So wouldn't this be something that you could see, the Republicans get behind to say, hey, look, we don't want government services to have to supplement your business model. I mean, isn't there an opportunity to be bipartisan here?
Oh, I certainly believe that. Although, you know, if I believe the Republicans really didn't understand that, then I would be naive.
Wow.
You know, they're playing their game. And, you know, I would have to say politicians need to get behind this process of making sure that that corporations will pay their fair share. I mean, bottom line, McDonald's, they're making a $5.5 billion profit, but our research indicates that those workers that work for McDonald's, because they make such a low wage, government subsidies or government programs, social service programs, et cetera, $4.5 billion in additional support to those workers is going out. So, you know, we are essentially paying the price for this thing ourselves. And what we need to do, and somebody is, you know, skimming the big dollars off the top. All right. So, we need to get a grip on that and, change that situation. And again, that's why these workers are taking, you know, pretty, very courageous stand, because they can be terminated any time. They're at will with their employers. Yeah. They have no protection. So we as community folks have to stand with them. We have to provide them some level of protection and support. And as consumers, in these fast food industries, in the fast food industry, we can do that.
Let me ask you last line of questioning I've got for you. You know, like I said earlier, I saw this report on CNN, and I'm going, wow, almost a mainstream media outlet reporting on this. So I'm curious, you know, what kind of response are you getting there in St. Louis? Are you seeing media interest in this?
Oh, it's phenomenal. I mean, you're probably my 10th or 12th interview. I mean, I just completed an interview with BBC. You know, I've been kind of interviewed by every major, you know, media outlet in town. The coverage has been phenomenal in St. Louis. I'm not, you know, I don't know about other cities at this point, but although we'll have that data tomorrow. But remember this, you know, we haven't really started yet. Our main set of actions occurs tomorrow. I mean, what happened today was just a starting point in St. Louis. We have a huge number of restaurants and workers going out tomorrow. That will be our bigger day. So we're continuing the push, and believe me, that won't be the end of it. I mean, we've got a lot of actions during the whole course of this week where we return workers to the workplace. We have community leaders go back with workers, return them, and walk them back to their jobs. So that will be going on all week. But August should be, and September we're going to continue to move because the workers are moving, you know, and they're going to continue to reach. I mean, this time we've got 7 cities, which is an indication that, you know, we can do this thing in a broader and with a more national scope. So the next phase, I think, is even to expand that, and to do even much more to make this a national story.
Well, I'm looking forward to more. I'm looking forward.
And by the way, you know, that's all about, you know, all of us in the labor movement who want to see labor succeed. This is the Labor Day story. This is where we're pushing. You know, not that labor is losing speed. No, that labor is rising up, that these workers and workers all across America are rising up. And we will begin the process of organizing ourselves to get what we want.
I'm with you, Martin Raffanen. I appreciate the time. Please come back often, because as this goes down the road, we certainly want to have people come and tell us what's going on in places like St. Louis and around the country.
Things are going to be happening over the next month for sure. Believe me, you're going to have a lot to talk about.
I look forward to it, but I appreciate the time and look forward to you coming back. Thanks so much.
All right. You're welcome.
Martin
Bye.
Raffanen, Community Director for Can't Survive on 735 ST Lewis. 735.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Martin's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Stop the moochers, shouted a flock of GOP budget whackers in the U.S. House recently as they literally ripped all food stamp funding out of the farm bill. They say they are shocked that use of this program has jumped so dramatically in recent years, crying that those people are costing us money. The House whacked the entire budget for getting food to the poor. Well, yes, food stamp use is up, but hello, clueless Congress critters. So is the need. Long-term joblessness and falling wages are sucking more and more of your constituents out of the middle class down into the vortex of poverty. It's disgraceful for you well-paid lawmakers to gut a poverty program that's working exactly as it's meant to do, at the very time it's most needed. But next, the flock of budget whackers suddenly flew completely off course, going from disgraceful to disgusting. They approved the farm bill that gives ridiculous taxpayer handouts to the biggest and richest agribusiness operations in our land. Those entities are wallowing in record-high crop prices and farm income this year, yet the GOP's pious deficit skulls turned into free-spending corporate socialists, doling out the most generous farm subsidies in U.S. history. For example, they perverted the crop insurance program into an absurd guaranteed income plan for the wealthiest farms, each of which will collect more than $1 million a year from us. Moreover, these free market Republicans would also have the government, i.e. you and me, guarantee an artificially high price for various commodities produced by the giant farms. And they would make all of these subsidies permanent. This is Jim Hightower saying, no grocery money for the needy, but a free feed for millionaire farmers? That's a moral abomination. For more information and action, contact the Environmental Working Group, www.ewg.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So on Sunday on CNN State of the Union, there had Jack Lew, Treasury Secretary, who has come out and said, well, you know what? No bailout for you, Detroit. Screw you. We did the banks. We did the auto industry, but not you. Katie Crowley asked, no, you bailed out the banks, you bailed out the auto industry, you gave them loans, you did all of this stuff to make sure that they didn't go bankrupt. Why not the city of Detroit? And Lew's response was kind of interesting. He said, I think the situation we had in 2009 and 10 was unique and something that hopefully we'll never see again. That was the response. He said it's very unlikely that Detroit will be able to pull itself out of the crisis on its own, which I agree that there's just no way they're going to be able to do it on their own. They're going to need some federal help. They're going to need some state help. But you've got the governor there saying, not so much. We're going to let them go through bankruptcy, and we're going to screw those pensioners. You look at the guy who's running the city, the city dictator, a guy named Kevin Orr, which is an interesting story of himself, you know, with the law firm that he works for and their dealings. That's a whole other story. But you look at what he's done in the slash public services, slashed employment. You got a third of the ambulances in the city that are actually functional and operating. Like 40% of the streetlights actually work. This is going to come down to, the city has about $20 billion in debt that it can't pay. It's going to come down to investors versus workers. It's going to come down to hedge funds or retirees. And the way the scales have been weighted is that the hedge funds and the corporations, they're going to get theirs. And, well, granny, sorry, workers, sorry, you're out of luck. because Kevin Orr, the city dictator there, has already made it quite clear that the pensioners, they're going to get hit. They're going to be cuts to their $1,600 a month pension, which I got to be honest, you think about $1,600 a month, not an awful lot of money. But they're going to be the ones hit. And, you know, the banks, well, they're going to walk away. And I looked at this story today that really just grabbed me. Bank profits, the financial industry, they are on the verge of becoming the largest sector in the S&P 500 index. They have bounced back mightily from the crisis that they caused. Bloomberg reported that the financial industry comprised almost 17% of the index, nearly twice as much as they did before the crash. Think about that for a second. They're fat and happy. Profits up 27%. 95% of the bank's holding companies trading in cash and derivatives go through just five firms. You've got this mass concentration of wealth into very small hands. And yet you've got the city dictator and the governor of Michigan and really the whole machinery going to steal these retirees' pensions. And there is a glimmer of hope. You know, much like here in Pennsylvania, Attorney General Kathleen Kane stopped the lottery privatization, which was on the fast track. Michigan's Attorney General, who's a Republican, said over the weekend he's going to defend the retirees in the bankruptcy court. A guy named Bill Schuette. He said, equally staggering is the financial uncertainty of pension benefits relied upon by Michigan seniors living on fixed incomes and anticipating a safe and secure retirement after a lifetime of work. He went on to say retirees may face a potential financial crisis not of their own making. He went on to pledge to defend the rights of Michigan citizens and to defend the Constitution of the state of Michigan. And I go through and I start thinking about what's going on here in Pennsylvania as they keep going, oh, we need to do something with those pensions. And I think of, you know, this guy's probably right. It's going to be unconstitutional. Because as I've read it, their laws are pretty clear. You've got to protect the people because it's constitutional. Just a thought. What happens again if we do that here in Pennsylvania? How much money are we wasting? How much resource are we wasting on another bad outcome in another court proceeding? All because we have this ideology that says we're going to steal from the retirees. We're going to gerrymander. We're going to privatize this. We're going to push a law that says no local control. I mean, you go down the list and you think about all of the things and all of the money and all of the, and you just go, at some point, just stop. I mean, because this is going to trigger a huge court battle. And you know who gets wealthy in these? The attorney firms. You know, the Jones Day. And I look at this and I go, you know, at some point, it's going to turn back around. But I was surprised to see the governor of Michigan, the attorney general, say he's going to stand up for the workers. Maybe there is a feeling. Maybe there is a groundswell. Maybe it's boiling. It's percolating under the surface. The explosion of a great awakening is going to happen. That everything we've been told the last 30 years is a big pile of BS. Well, I guess one could hope. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
to the Rick Smith Show.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
You are listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
News from my lefty friends, the end of conservative talk radio, or so they thought when they saw the reports that Cumulus was going to be dumping Limbaugh and Hannity. And they said, don't get carried away. They're dumping them because they don't want to pay for it. This is purely a business move. It's not an ideological anything. At least that's my view on it. And I think probably at the end of this, you'll probably see it, they'll drop the price a little bit. More people will pick it up. It is what it is. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world in Washington, D.C. I've got Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. So what do you think, Alan? The end of the Limbaugh and Hannity era?
No, I think it's the end of their cost. And, you know, a lot of shows actually not only pay for their time, they buy the advertising, and then they resell it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the nature of the beast. And if Cumulus thinks they're going to be able to make more money the other way,
well, they can do a local host for probably less, own the avails. It may be the beginning of local talk radio again.
I'm hoping for that, because at the end of the day, why should you have one guy that you're really never going to be able to talk to or doesn't know any of the local issues? Because I'm a big fan of local.
Everybody is. I mean, the locals certainly are a big fan of local.
Yeah. So did you follow the big news today of Hillary and the president had lunch together?
Well,
the picture was everywhere.
Yes, they had lunch together. What was also interesting is we were at the White House. I wasn't, but Justin was. And Robert Gibbs attended a team recognition event at the White House. Now, did he do that as cover, Was it really also a lunch between Robert Gibbs, who was, of course, the president's press secretary, and Hillary Clinton to talk about a presidential run? We don't know, but it's very interesting.
You know, when we were on the People's Tour for America, we happened to the Eisenhower Library in Abilene, Kansas.
Right.
And the curator who took us on the tour and we did an interview with highlighted the fact that Ike had not decided to run until June of 52, actually didn't begin campaigning until Labor Day of 52 for the 1952 election.
Well, it's also interesting that he couldn't at that point decide. He was being courted by both the Democrats and the Republicans. I just finished an interesting biography about Ike. And he couldn't decide, but then he just decided because for tax, his feelings about taxes and the economy that he could not be a Democrat.
Yeah. I just thought it was interesting. September, starting the election, the campaigning in September.
Pretty amazing.
2 months. 2 months of campaigning.
Right.
And here we are. It's not even, we're still 3 years away.
And I know. And we're hearing about the steak fries out in Iowa and all that stuff. Okay. Oh, give me a break.
So do you think the Wiener scandal came up? Because evidently, according to some of my really conservative friends, Huma, she is the biggest national security threat that we have today.
Well, I understand. But, you know, none other than John McCain got on the floor of the Senate and defended her about 3 or 4 months ago.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was ridiculous then. I thought it had gone away, but since...
Because she was raised in Saudi Arabia. She's not an American. Give me a break.
Yeah, well, I thought it was interesting. And I really think it's interesting that the take on this whole Wiener thing. There was a woman who was on Fox News. She did one of the Fox programs, and her name escapes me off the top of my head. I think it's something like Goldstein, Brooke Goldstein from the Lawfare Project. She said that the real question is, why is Wiener so unattracted to Huma? Is it because she's connected with Islamists who want to kill us?
And oh, going, my gosh. I think she didn't really say that.
She did. I'm going, is this news?
Wow.
I mean, this whole thing's really got, and she called it a Manchurian marriage, and I mean, just really bizarre. Fox has really gone off the deep end.
Well, it's summertime.
I guess it is. Did you see this Lauren Green on Fox News? She did an interview with this Rez Aslan, who wrote the book Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. And her only question is, how can you write the book because you're a Muslim?
It's amazing. He was actually on the Bill Maher show with Bob Ney the other night talking about his book and Bob Ney's book. I was very impressed with him, actually.
Yeah, I was too. And I mean, he handled her perfectly. That's not something she'll want to put on any resume she ever uses, because he handled her completely. And it was the same, you know, she kept going. And then at one point she even goes, well, let's go look in our chat room for a question, because basically I have nothing, which was kind of funny.
Wow, that is unbelievable. I didn't hear that one.
Yeah, it's interesting. Also, the president held a meeting today with the civil rights leaders?
Yes, he did. And this has to do with the Voting Rights Act. Eric Holder, as you know, is going to pursue what is left of the Voting Rights Act after the Supreme Court sort of did it in. And they're going to use, as they say, everything possible to get districts that they don't feel are complying with the law to comply with the law.
Yeah, did you see what Justice Ginsburg had to say?
I didn't actually.
Basically, I told you so. You know, when it came before the Supreme Court, she said, you know, I didn't want to be right, but sadly, I'm right, because now you're going to see all of these attacks, and when you left part of it in place, it's going to be court challenge after court challenge. It's really going to be very interesting to see where this goes from here.
Well, it is going to be interesting, and Holder is going to use every trick in the book. And I saw a lot of these people on the White House driveway afterwards, and, you know, they were sort of talking to each other, figuring out what their next strategy was going to be.
And the sad thing is, I don't think if you have to go back and pass a law, I don't think there's any way it could happen.
Well, you can't even pass basic budget.
Well, there's that. I mean, we can't even agree that hungry children should get fed. I mean, and that's, to me, when you're arguing that we're going to give a large amount of money to farmers and to agribusiness, And no money for children who are hungry. I got a problem with that. And I saw this story today that, you know, the Department of Agriculture is saying that the Government Accountability Office said that the Department of Agriculture is sending out millions of dollars to dead farmers.
Wow. Well, the point is, though, that something like 70% go to the top 5% or 10% of
agribusiness. No, it was worse than that.
Yeah.
It was 74% went to the top 4%.
Okay, you're absolutely right. You got a better memory than me.
Well, no, I mean,
but it was outrageous.
I mean, it is outrageous. You're talking about welfare for four people that suck up 74% of the whole pie. I mean, that's gluttonous.
Yes, and I agree with you, and I think it's awful. But the question is this Congress going to do anything? I mean, I got to tell you, I don't think we've ever seen a Congress as do nothing, and we've talked about other Congresses being do nothing.
I mean, I think this is worse than do nothing. Do nothing is like, okay, we're not going to cause any harm. We're just going to sit here. We're going to take up space. They're actively doing nothing in order to cause harm.
Yes, and in fact, sequestration came up again today. Harry Reid talked about it. General Ordinaro talked about it. I mean, people are aware of what's going on, but they don't want to seem to move things. And, you know, when these guys get home for the summer, I think just like on the NSA stuff, they're in for a big surprise.
Do you think the faithful will hold them to task? Because I don't know. I mean, I listen to some of the people that I talk to. You know, they're at the point now where well, it is what it is. My guy's okay.
Really? I think people are going to be more upset than they think. I really do. And that's why even some of the Republicans moved to where they are now. And I think when they go home, they're going to hear it about the budget, too.
I mean, this whole sequestration thing. I mean, at the end of the day, no one can explain to me how pulling money out of the economy is good. No one has been able to effectively explain why austerity isn't working in the UK or anywhere else that it's been in practice. But somehow, magically, it'll work here.
Yes, and that is, you know, again, I think people are going to go home for that August recess, and they're going to find out that people are not happy campers. And I know, again, you know, the general in the Army talked about how hard it is to train people with this money coming back.
Yeah, what do you say? They're cutting the budget of the Pentagon by, what, $85 million next year?
Right.
So that they're not going to be able to recruit?
Did I say, yeah, 85, right, million.
Sorry, 85 right. Billion.
Right.
But they're not going to be able to effectively recruit because, you know what, we need them to go out and forge war.
Well, no, I understand. But the point is that you have to be at least somewhat ready.
And the other thing is that I've seen reports that, you know, if you undid the sequestration and put things back to where they were, over the next year and a half, it would create something like 1.6 million new jobs. And I've seen a couple numbers. But
well,
the high
there's
one
numbers
being,
between 700 and your number, but they're somewhere between that.
Yeah, I've seen it as high as and as low as 600, but we're still talking about positive job numbers. We're still talking about moving forward as opposed to contracting and moving backward.
Right. Exactly.
See, you know,
I'm a dumb
truck driver, and I get this stuff. It's not that difficult.
Well, you're not a dumb truck driver. You maybe have been a truck driver, but you're not dumb. And the problem is that they don't see that most Americans can figure it out, too. Most of us are at least have a high school education. We've done some algebra. We've done some geometry. You know, not that difficult.
No, I mean, this isn't rocket science. And I know rocket scientists who go, it's not rocket science.
Right.
Okay, so what we could do, and in my view, what I've been saying is I've been on this kick. You know, one of our Republicans here in the state decided that they're going to have a poverty tour. They're going to go around listening to people on poverty like they've never seen it. And I say one of the things that they should be doing is raising the minimum wage at the minimum. And fortunately, I saw today thousands of fast food workers and other low-wage workers out in the streets took to the streets on strike. And it was covered on the news today, Ellen. That's what shocked me.
Really?
I saw it on CNN today. They actually had, Wolf was actually talking to a couple of people, which I thought was extremely impressive, that a worker issue has actually hit something of a mainstream outlet.
Wow. That is unbelievable, because usually it is all quiet on the Western and Eastern front on that.
Yeah, I mean, I was shocked. We were sitting in the bar having lunch, and I looked over, and I'm going, what? must be a slow news day. Although it wasn't. I mean, I look at, you know.
No, I mean, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, I mean, there were some suicide bombings. Iraq, another, what, 58 people killed?
That's right. In primarily Shiite neighborhoods. I mean, how do these people consider themselves religious?
I have no idea. Other than you've really twisted whatever basic, decent concept that the religion started with, you have completely twisted and mangled that up to who knows what now. And that's on just about any religion, in my view. It's all of them. When you really begin to contort them and twist them into some psychotic, sick, deranged mentality, I think you get that no matter where you're at.
Yes, you do. And it doesn't matter. And we have them in all religions, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I mean, there's actually been some research on that religious brain, so to speak, and what happens. Some people think it's in the temporal lobe, et cetera.
Yeah, well, so you said last week that when the front shrinks, you become more conservative. So a shrinking of the front of the brain, a little more conservative. Another part of the brain, you become insane, right?
Well, yes. There's several parts of the brain you can become insane.
And most of them seem to be running our government. Interesting news. I guess tomorrow could be the Bradley Manning decision?
Yes, it will be the Bradley Manning decision. There could be other appeals. He did not want a military jury. He wanted the judge to make this decision. I don't know why he decided that. He's looking at everything from time served to life imprisonment.
So what's the inside money? I'm thinking life in prison. Got to make an example of it.
I don't know. I mean, I'd be surprised if he gets more than 20 years, honestly.
Really? No,
yeah.
Will that be making gravel in Leavenworth or somewhere else?
Probably Leavenworth.
Yeah. Sad, sad stuff.
Yes, and as you know, he's got a lot of support.
Yeah, I support him.
I do too.
You know, and the Snowden guy too. I mean,
listen, I think Snowden is an American hero. Never had this discussion if it not been for Snowden.
Nope. And you know, we've our government said we won't execute him. Well, that's nice of you.
Yeah, exactly.
And finally, it looks like we're going to have an FBI director.
Yes, we are going to have an FBI director. He was approved by 93-1 vote. The one vote was Rand Paul. The two senators from Oregon voted present.
Okay, that still leaves us with 96. Where are the other four?
I think some people just weren't around.
Not that their vote really mattered. But I find it interesting. Here's another Bush-era guy now going to be one of the...
Yeah, and they were almost not going to bring it to the floor.
Yeah, and why? Why? You know, why? What I'm waiting for, I'm really waiting for the fireworks over the NLRB people.
Oh, my gosh. Well, no, but you see, that was a deal that was made. And the deal was made, you get rid of the last two NLRB people, and we'll put these two in.
Just because, and I think they're basically,
the nominations came that night,
yeah,
or that afternoon. So clearly it was part of the deal, and the names were floated as part of the deal.
Yeah, it was an inside gig from the beginning. But even still, I mean, the two that they nominated are almost identical to the two that were there with their credentials.
Yes, it was just a deal to save face.
It was just my sandbox. I need to be able to say I did accomplish something, and that's all this was about. A two-year-old sandbox politic.
That's a great way of putting it. You ought to write a book called that.
Anyway, it's always great talking with you, Alan. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Our good friend Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around here. There's another Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
Never you will look back again.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone, by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Up on the quote from former Indiana and current Florida school chief Tony Bennett, not the singer Tony Bennett, but the school destroyer in this case, what he wrote in the email: I hope we come to the meeting today with solutions and not excuses and or explanations for me to wiggle myself out of the repeated lies I have told over the past 6 months. Not how do we fix the schools to make sure that the kids learn and actually attain the grades that we're inevitably going to give them. No, we wouldn't want that. We need to figure out how we can save my skin, how we can save face and still, continue on our misguided ideological journey towards privatizing and profitizing public education. Nice. It just makes you shake your head. Anyway, I got an email from Andy. He points out that when Pat had set in for me recently, Mr. Obama was shown films of the. He writes, Mr. Obama was shown films of President John F. Kennedy's assassination, among others, to get his mind right to embrace neoliberal policies. He writes, Stosh nailed it. Original NSA whistleblower Russell Tice admitted he saw the results of eavesdropping on Mr. Obama before he was elected president. The generals in the Pentagon all have voice and data on all the politicians. Everyone in our government is subject to blackmail and bribery from the people with J. Edgar Hoover-style surveillance. And that's absolutely true. I mean, and that's on everybody. That's why there's part of me that wishes the whole Anthony Weiner thing, we would just go grow up and go, yeah, people do that. I don't care. I mean, I really don't care. If he's having conversations with someone else, those are private conversations between consenting adults. If there's a problem with him and his wife, that's between him and his wife. It has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with policy. Our problem is we've got our heads stuck so far in other people's bedrooms. That policy be damned. Not that Weiner would be a great mayor. I don't know if he would or if he wouldn't be. Probably couldn't be any worse than Bloomberg has been. But this whole obsession with people's personal lives, you know, the whole reason, you know, my wife and I have talked about this, because I have considered a time or two of running for an office of some sort, because nobody else does where I live. The guy who's the House rep here in the state ran unopposed. So all of the bad things that Stephen Bloom brings to the table, all of the bad policy that he pursues and that he pushes and advocates for, nobody knows about because he hasn't met with a challenger. And my wife's like, you know, I don't want you in that fishbowl. You're not putting the family in that. And that's the other part of this. You know, if I could without doubt, unequivocally step forward and say, you know what, all the slings and arrows right here. I'm strong enough to take it. I'm big enough to take whatever you've got. I will live up to my past. I will live up to whatever skeletons I have in my closet because I've chosen to step forward. But I know that's not where it ends. I mean, you look at the ugliness that we were talking about with, you know, with Wiener's wife. I mean, you know, and the stuff that goes on with, it's insane. And policy is so far down the list of what's important. It's just one of those things that makes good people run from public life. And we end up with dirtbags and con men and idiots and people who are able to win a popularity contest and not understand good public policy or care. That's the part that bothers me. And you know, I don't doubt that there's a dossier on just about every one of us. At some point or another, we've all sent an email or a text or who knows. And look, the NSA knows it. This stuff's all being collected somewhere. If you send an email, you send a text, you write anything down, it's somewhere. Somebody's got it. It's somewhere. So as a society, there's part of me that goes, you know what? I don't care what you do within the confines of your four walls. If Anthony Weiner wants to talk dirty to somebody on the other side of the country with their little cell phone, well, God bless him. I don't care. I said it. It's that simple. I don't care. The amazing thing to me in this, at least Bill Clinton got something. If you're going to be, you know, the adulterer and you're going to be targeted and you're going to be attacked, at least get something. Wiener's gotten, well, nothing. And someone said to me, well, how do you know he's got nothing? Look, if they've got every text that he's sent and they know all of the people, somebody would come forward, don't you think? Not that I'm a huge Wiener fan. I just said he. Never mind. Not that I'm a big fan. But at the end of it, it comes down to us, folks. It comes down to what's important. Do you really care about that part of his life, or do you care about policy? For me, you know, I care about the guy's voting record. I care about what the guy proposes to get the country and get us out of the mess we're in. Our problem is we're too preoccupied with other people's personal lives. We need to be worried about our public lives. It's that simple for me. Andy, thanks for the email. Of course, you can email me anytime, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you've missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com is where you go to get the podcast or a Stitcher app for your smartphone. Take the program on the go. And, of course, if you missed any portion of the show, it's there. But I'd like you to go take a look at PeoplesTourForAmerica.com. Take a look at our labor history tour. Still some things there to see. And I'm still getting comments from people, things they enjoyed, things that if we ever do it again, to do better. And I'm thinking we're going to. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the sway.